Welcome to the Justice League Universe podcast. I'm Sam.
And I'm Rebecca.
And we are going to be doing a full commentary of the film Wonder Woman 1984. We try to keep things positive here on the JLU podcast. I can't promise that this will be entirely positive, but we will try to look for the bright side of things when we can. And I think we'll find some things that we can appreciate. But we can also give our honest opinions as other things come up.
Yeah, there are actually some good things about this movie. So, I mean, there's some things that I'm sure we'll have critiques about it, but there are actually some pretty bright spots in there for me. So I'm excited to revisit it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it, too, like a lot of movies, is about the mindset that you bring into the movie. If you want to get mad and frustrated and angered by some of the choices, you can. If you want to try to look for some positive things and have, you know, a good time with certain parts of it, you can do that also. So we are going to be doing a commentary. If you want to synchronize with us and watch the movie along as we go, we have it paused at the 8-second mark, which is right when the logo switches to DC. So when it flickers over to DC, hit pause, and we will get started with that together. So, Rebecca, you ready to go?
Yeah, are we doing 3-2-1 play, or are we doing
let's do 3-2-1 play, and we'll play on the play. All right, cool. Here we go. 3-2-1 play. All right. I wasn't sure what to expect with this movie. The posters leading up to it were not as, I don't know, they didn't grab me as much as the original movie, but I loved the first Wonder Woman. So I was ready to go back to this world, back to these characters.
Yeah, that's so interesting because the images that were coming out that were 1980s retro were very exciting for me, actually. So I really wanted more 80s vibes out of this movie, but did not get as much as I was hoping for. But I love this opening sequence where it goes back to Themyscira. So I think it kind of gets us back into that space from that first Wonder Woman movie.
Yeah. And this is one of the positive things, I think, is going back to Themyscira, the green, the natural sort of environment, which I think will contrast with the malls and the kind of consumerism of man's world.
Right.
Like before, we contrasted Themyscira and its purity and its goodness with war and with the dirtiness of man's world. This one, I think, is going to contrast, again, that purity, the green, the nature of Themyscira with the consumerism and the sort of modern culture of man's world, which is more about spending money and accumulating and stuff rather than like the dirt and violence of war, but still I think a worthwhile contrast to explore. And yeah, I was happy to be like, all right, this is a nice way to get us back in Themyscira, because Themyscira isn't as central to like the main plot of this movie, but this opening is a nice way to just get us back in the world, revisit these characters and things.
Yeah, it is a paradise, and it's all about the natural land, the natural world versus some of the other things that Diana is going to encounter when she goes back to or when she is in man's world, not, I guess, go back to it. But yeah, this actually looked, I saw this in IMAX, and sequence was, I believe, shot in IMAX, and it looked great. The other parts of the movie weren't as good as in IMAX, but this sequence really was great.
Yeah. I watched this at home during like the winter break of 2020 going into 2021. So I didn't get to have the big, you know, full movie theater experience just because of the times. But even when we did watch this, this opening sequence was very well received by myself and also my wife, Chelsea, who was watching it. Again, just to be back in, you know, all the women around, their athletic prowess, you know, their skills of what they're able to do. And what my wife commented on that was really impactful for her was to see a young girl who is physically capable of amazing things shown like in a movie. Because my wife, kind of speaking for my wife, but she was describing to me how, first of all, when she was growing up, there weren't as many girl characters in movies at all. It was a lot of boys' stuff, it was a lot of men's kind of framings. So she's like, first of all, it's not often that you get a young girl as the lead. But when you do get a young girl as the lead, it's usually more about they're quirky or they're smart or they're bookish or like those kinds of characters. And she's like, she doesn't remember it being shown that this young girl is physically very impressive and can do feats of, you know, strength and agility and stuff. So for her, she's like, wow, like this is a cool entry into the movie pantheon to have a young girl that can do all these things she's about to do.
Well, she does have a little bit of an advantage. See, she is the daughter of Zeus. So she does have something up on just a normal girl. But I love the aspect of getting to see the Themyscira culture and see what they do for fun. You know, this is something that they do to have a competition amongst the people of the island. And it's really cool to see their traditions and the things that they do that would be comparable, I guess, to some of the things we do, like a Super Bowl or the Olympics or something like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of neat to see what Themyscira does in its free time.
Right. Because at this point, they don't have any external threats to really worry about. They're a very functional kind of society. And so they can just challenge themselves like in a positive, productive way. Like, let's just push ourselves in kind of friendly competition.
And this is actually something that I think they pulled from the George Perez run of Wonder Woman, because in that she is, and I think the Wonder Woman TV show with Linda Carter also touches on this a little bit in that pilot, where there's a competition to sort of get Diana to be the representative of the Atlanteans. That's Aquaman. The Amazons to Man's World. Now, this is not exactly that competition to do that, but I think it has the spirit of it. I was pleasantly surprised to see that because I'm such a big fan of that comic book run.
Yeah. That dive was a nice little visual echo of the first movie when she dives in for Steve Trevor. But yeah, I think you're right with the connection to the comics. And in that one, I think Diana like disguises herself to kind of, you know, get into the competition secretly. And here it's more the age difference is what kind of separates her out to it. But she's doing well. Return to the horseback, which is also a big part of the first movie, memorable part with the horses.
Now, do you think there's something significant about her choosing a black horse?
Ah, I hadn't thought about it. She does have her hair also looks kind of jet black at this point.
Because usually heroes are depicted as riding a white horse. So I thought it was a choice, I guess, for Patty Jenkins to say, no, Diana's going to be riding a black horse.
Right. I just like the setting, too. The beach is familiar, but the, you know, Themyscira in the background looks really good. The world is well rendered, I think, in this whole sequence.
And I like that there's not a lot said. There's a monologue at the beginning, some narration by Diana that I personally don't think is needed. I think you can do without the narration. But I like that a lot of this sequence is just we're in it. Like I feel immersed in this sequence because I'm trying to follow along what's going on and trying to be there with Diana. And so I like the ability to follow the action without being told what's happening.
Yeah, I agree that narration at the beginning is there. I think for the parallelism of how the first movie started with the narration, something about learning a lesson or something, which it, you know, connect back to it later. But I agree. Like when I was watching this the first time, it was just some nice action, seeing the girl carrying her way forward. But you also just had the sense of something's going to happen here. Like there's a reason they're showing us this competition. There's something that's going to happen by the end. And I was very curious about what it was going to be. It's cool with the smoke too, as the way to track like the progress around the racetrack.
That's a pretty great slow mo shot of.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, that's nice.
Poor sleep.
Good use of slow mo. It can be overdone sometimes, but that was a good use of it. Yeah. And the music is great.
Yep, music's very good. And the mother looking on, you know, we can connect a lot to their mother-daughter dynamic from the first movie. And here it's mostly unspoken, but just in the look of the mother, we sort of know their relationship, protective relationship, but also sort of, you know, appreciating her achievements, but also wanting to protect her a lot.
Maybe the black horse is indicative of Diana's competitiveness in this, you know, like she loses her horse. And it's been such a long time since I've seen this, but Diana doesn't. She doesn't win. I guess we'll see her in a second.
But
I think there's some sketchiness that goes on with it. So maybe that's related to the choice of the black horse.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, she spotted the shortcut. She's headed on the shortcut. Yep. I just noticed right before she went in the tunnel, she crossed her arms over her chest. Kind of a slight little Wonder Woman move there.
Yep.
But yeah, so here we get to the lesson that's going to be happening is we're sort of realizing, oh, she's not making it to the checkpoint. So what's going on? But then the shortcut gives her this advantage.
So maybe the black horse is like, she's a cheater. But it does show that she's smart and that she's able to go with whatever comes her way. You know, she's able to roll with punches.
Right. She has a lot of capabilities shown here and resourcefulness, but it's like technically not following the rules of the competition here.
Right, right.
Yeah. So I think in terms of setting a marker down, you know, there's going to be this lesson that's going to come home in a strong way here about not cheating. And you can't just take the easy way to your outcome, which I think we can then kind of trace through the rest of the movie.
Oh, big time.
You can tell the little girl, too, that she's excited that she has the chance to win this thing.
Yeah. And this young actress is very good.
Yeah. And boom, down in Taipei. So that seems believable, a little girl being like, that's not fair.
Yeah.
But Antiope has the words of wisdom here.
And I think it's very fitting. Oh, well, and here she's talking about the truth. You know, Wonder Woman is all about the truth. And so to have Wonder Woman, essentially a young Diana who would become Wonder Woman, cheat and not be about the truth. You know, she needs to learn that lesson. But I think it's really fitting here that Antiope is the one who gives her these life lessons. I know it just probably would be nice to have her mother do it, but I think Antiope was always that character who was trying to mentor her and train her. And so I think it's really fitting that she is the one to speak to her in that way.
Yeah, I agree. Like in the first movie, the mother kind of tells the history of the family and Diana and where they come from. But Antiope was the one that had that voice on her shoulder, like wisdom right into her ear kind of thing. And also Antiope being the one that's training the general, like she's the one that's going to enforce the rules. Like, no, that is not the way you win. That's not the way you get to the goal. You can't take shortcuts.
She's the Themyscira referee, I guess.
Yeah. And then you can have the mother can take more of the comforting role of like, right. Okay, I know this is hard for you, but one day.
Yeah, they mentioned Asteria, who will come back into play towards the end of this.
Yep. So and I also, I noticed there too, the mother said, you will one day become all that you dream of. There's the dream kind of connection there too. So we've got truth laid down pretty strong. We've got no shortcuts. You can't take the easy path to your outcome. You've got to kind of earn it. Oh yeah. There's the big statue of, All right. Oh, there. Now that's some 80s.
Yeah, I really like the aesthetic of Wonder Woman 1984. It promised a lot of things, but I think there should have been a little more 80s music. It's a one quibble for me. But
especially when you have Hans Zimmer, who cut his teeth doing 80s synth pop kind of stuff.
He was in the first ever music video, Video Killed the Radio Star. He should have been let loose on this.
So, we can kind of analyze as we go through here the 80s-ness of it. So, obviously, they went for an 80s outfit there.
They had the cars.
For me, a lot of people criticized some of the action gags and choices that were made. The way I tried to interpret it was that they were going for, like, 80s-style action, which was a little bit silly, was a little bit, like, filmed in an exaggerated kind of way, not in, like, a gritty, realistic sort of way.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is throwing back to movies of the 1980s. Sometimes I think about with this one, I think it's Superman 3 that starts off with like a lot of silly action. So it sort of has that same feel to it. So I think it's intentionally trying to be like that.
Right. Now, if some people are not into the 80s at all, they'll probably just hate this the whole way through almost.
I try to see it as what is it intending to do. And I think Patty Jenkins was always inspired by the Richard Donner Superman movies. And I think this is her kind of reaching into that well a little bit. But I think the shopping mall and all of that, I think is really very, very 80s.
Yeah, that was kind of a cultural center at that point.
Yep.
And then, definitely the accumulation of nice things sort of thing. We got our first little villains kind of come in. All right. A little bit exaggerated. The costuming is interesting with these villains too. But I was going to say, too, on that part, Patty Jenkins is definitely a fan of the 1970s Wonder Woman. And I think even some of the ways they do some of this mall action is also almost like a 70s TV style of action instead of like a modern movie kind of action sequence.
Yeah, and I appreciate that to a degree because it separates Wonder Woman 2017 from Wonder Woman 1984. It's two distinct movies. Even if you don't like it, it's definitely trying to be its own thing and trying to do something different. It's not just retreading. Well, some of it is retreading, I guess, what they did in the first movie. But I think this one holds its own in terms of trying to be different.
Yeah. This is now, this guy being kind of exaggerated klutz to me does seem kind of 80s.
Well, criminals are usually not very smart.
Especially criminals in the 80s movies.
Yeah. He's got his sleeves rolled up like he's on Miami Vice.
And just not chill at all when they're trying to trying to get away stealthy. He's like, nope, he's not stealthy.
Yeah, they did not have a great exit strategy.
Going up the down escalator was their strategy.
That's hard. I'm surprised the mall cops are really trying to do something.
And they're armed. Wow, yeah. And then now, so to me, this is also, it's like you kind of got to go with the over-exaggerated, a little bit silly. Like, okay, now he's just going to grab this kid. And like, geez, you are escalating things unnecessarily here, dude.
Well, there has to be a reason for Wonder Woman to show up.
Yeah.
Mall cops maybe could handle it. The police could be coming in.
Right.
But right now they're endangering a young girl's life. Only one woman can swoop in and stop that.
That's true. And like stolen objects is not really a Wonder Woman level problem. But yeah, like
saving a little girl's life. Yeah.
There we go.
And I will say that's a great moment for, you know, this is the first time we see Wonder Woman. And that's a great moment. There's a lot more usage of the lasso in here. That I kind of want to track as we go through here.
Yeah, and I know, so she shows up, she's got the lasso. She's just basically saying, like, okay, you're outmatched, dude. I like, you know, this is not too challenging for her. She can handle this pretty easily. So I kind of like her tone here of confidence, which I think kind of works with this silly gang of thieves. It's like, Wonder Woman can take care of you with one hand tied behind her back, basically.
Yeah, she has to be careful not to accidentally murder these guys because, I mean, she's very powerful.
Yeah.
Like, even throwing that little girl, she had to be really careful.
Yeah, be very glide gentle with that. But to me, all right, so you could just say this is silly, it's a little too corny or funny, but to me, the movie has kind of let you know we're in the 80s right now. Like, this scene to me has consistency in tone. It's just that not everybody likes the tone that they've chosen for this kind of sequence.
Yeah.
But I feel like it was a creative choice that they did this on purpose. This is what they were going for from the start of the scene all the way to here. And this little defying physics a little bit, like, that's not how he would have tripped if she actually kicked him.
Yeah. I think it's a great sequence.
Yeah, and even the wink fits in with the last 5 minutes that we've just been watching, you know, so.
Yeah, and having her save two little girls, I think, is also very significant.
Yeah.
Just because Wonder Woman is all about, you know, sisterhood and, you know, the Amazons are all about that. So I like that it's two little girls that she gets to save in that sequence.
Yeah, and it connects to the fact we just saw her as a little girl, so she can kind of empathize. She can connect with those young girls as well.
Right. What do you think about her taking out the camera to try to, I guess, stick with the BBS?
I guess it was just a little bit of, I mean, a lot of people saw her. But I guess by showing that she took out the cameras, it's just this little bit of, you could plausibly argue that she's trying to be off the grid, sort of, or keep a low profile. But not that low of a profile. I mean, she's interacting with the public. And
she was also there during World War II and the Holocaust. And, you know, she's been around. So I guess it's more she's like a mythological being. I guess, you know, people see her, but there's no record of her existence, I guess.
Yeah, there's a nice couple throwbacks to the first movie, just showing that she still carries the memories of, you know, World War I era and beyond with her. But yeah, I mean, I think, if you want to be a real stickler, you can say it didn't follow the continuity of BBS. If you want to be a little more generous, you can sort of just say that she was metaphorically expressing disappointment in mankind, that she kind of like walled herself off from mankind a little bit. Not literally she hid from mankind for a century or something. But it's a stretch. You just have to kind of decide whether you want to be a real continuity stickler for BVS or if you want to give it a little bit of freedom for the creators to take a little bit of a different expression on things.
Yeah. And I know some people probably would think, oh, it's so crazy that she, you know, 40 years later, she doesn't seem to be involved romantically with anybody else or whatever. And I sort of get it. You know, she loves Steve Trevor and she mm-hmm. that was hard for her. So so I don't really I can buy that it would be difficult for her to overcome. And here she is, you know, single at this cafe.
Well, and also for her, 70, 80 years or whatever, or 60 years is not the same as it would be for us. Like right. For her, 60 years might just be a fairly reasonable mourning period if you're living for centuries and centuries.
Yeah. And it's like, how do you date somebody when you never age? You never, you know, they're going to age. I guess it's that Superman Lois Lane thing too. But yeah. But I like the idea that she's still kind of in the world. She's still actively in it, but it's mm-hmm. still, it's hard for her. You know, there's an emotional journey she has to go on.
Yep. So we've had the photo reminders. We can tell that she's thinking about Steve with the flights. Yep. Keeping the reminder of him, which, all right. Totally different kind of costume here wardrobe choice.
Still very 80s, I think.
Yep. And that backpack with kind of the flowery, colorful print or something.
Yeah, I have. I work in with museums, and I have a lot of museum friends that had a lot of issues with this movie and the way they depicted the Smithsonian.
Uh-huh. And maybe the way they handle certain objects, probably yes. not up to
this,
protocol.
This is not how you would handle collections, the way that they have done this. You're never supposed to take something from collections home. but I think it's interesting that in this here, in this movie, she is working in a museum. We see her in Zack Snyder's mm-hmm. Justice League as like a, I guess she's still kind of, she's in the Louvre, so she's in a different museum. But I like that she has different places that she's been, but she's still in that position.
Yeah, yeah, she has sort of a field, but can take on different roles at different times.
Yeah.
There's a little, nice little foreshadowing. Cheetah growl. So Diana was friendly, helping her out a little bit, but not too friendly though. She's like, I still have some other work to do. But it sort of sets so we've had the reminder of her relationship with Steve, and now we have this new relationship budding. So we're kind of going to follow those through the movie. This new relationship, where it goes, and then the Steve relationship from before and how that comes back around.
Yeah, I can imagine from Barbara's point of view, it's a little weird for her because if you met Diana and she was nice to you, it'd be like, oh my gosh, you know, because she's so beautiful. And I guess for me, I would assume that somebody that pretty would be nasty or somebody unpleasant, but she's very nice to Barbara and they strike up a little friendship.
Yeah. That was a good job by that actress. I don't know who that was, but yeah. She did a good job in her scene there. Yeah. And a little bit of plot moving forward, needing some help identifying some objects.
Yeah, this is actually pretty good in terms of the way they're showing objects just lying around with labels around them. That's pretty good to show collections. That's kind of how it is. You'd probably see a lot more drawers for things. Mm-hmm. You can see some drawers on the right side of them. So I think that's pretty accurate.
So in terms of story structure, we now are supposed to be interested in their relationship, their dynamic between each other. We have a little hint of Cheetah kind of thing, but also they're working on the main plot of the objects here.
And Barbara is going to be structurally giving us information about this this stone that's going to be very important to the plot. So I think it's nice that they introduce her as an intended villain, but It also helps drive the plot forward.
Connection again to Diana's formidable linguistic skills and knowledge of history is good. Yeah.
Yeah, that must be nice if you're trying to translate something.
I like the lines here for the side characters and the background characters, like giving a little bit more depth to this world here.
And it's helping us understand what this thing is doing and mm-hmm. how it works.
Yep, getting the first little hint of its powers there. That cat is weirdly framed right behind her head.
it's foreshadowing Cheetah, maybe.
Yeah.
It's very intentionally placed there, I think. I like the way that they show the wish, Diana making the wish, because it, you know, there's a little bit of a breeze in her hair.
Right.
There's a little bit of a sound effect. So you know as a viewer that something's happening.
Right. Nice. Yeah. It's not enough that they would notice it in the world of the movie, but it's enough that the audience sort of like, oh, I saw a little something there.
Right.
Yeah. So were you a Kristen Wiig fan kind of coming into this before, or this, you know, how did you feel with her coming into this part?
Oh yeah. I love Kristen Wiig. I loved her when she was on SNL. I think she's a great actress. She's a great comedian. She actually studied a lot of improv. So she is, I think, a very good actress. She's done actually a lot of good dramatic work too. So yeah. I was glad that she was getting the opportunity to do this. I wish they could have done more for her in terms of the writing and the direction.
Yeah.
I think for what she was given, I think she did a pretty good job. So I'm just glad she got the chance to do it.
Yeah, my thought is similar. Like, so I was excited about her being cast. I thought she did well. But then, yeah, as we trace things in the future, there might be some story decisions that were not as good. But I thought she was good for the role. And the parts that she had, especially with setting up this dynamic, I thought she did a good job. You almost start to root for her. You know, I thought she did a good job of getting some sympathy from the audience, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think she does a good job of making it personal for Barbara and making me care for her. I did notice the connection with the watch, Steve's watch. We saw it initially when Diana went home, but then after Diana makes the wish, there's a little bit of a wiggle to it. So it's, I think, hinting that Steve is out there somewhere.
Yeah. I think both actresses here do a good job. Like Diana, you know, Diana has this little sadness behind her face, you know, like you can kind of see that there, but she also has this confidence. Like she knows who she is. She's very comfortable with who she is. And then I think, you know, Barbara does a good job of conveying like, this woman is kind of desperate for acceptance. She needs more connections. She hasn't quite found herself yet. And I feel like both of them, even just in their body language, I think do a good job of bringing that across.
And I like the way it's written in their dynamic that they both envy each other to a certain degree, that they each have something that the other doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Now here they're giving explicit voice to the Steve things that we've of course been seeing as an audience. We know the background, but now actually it's coming out verbally from Diana here a little bit.
Yeah, we shouldn't be surprised when he shows up because they've been trying to hint at it.
And it was true. So there comes the true theme back again. Their love was true from before.
We see that they're in Washington, D.C. with the Washington Monument.
Yep, and then continuity of the monument there. I know this is sort of, it's kind of ham-handed a little bit of just like show Barbara being nice to somebody, you know, homeless or somebody that's kind of down on their luck, but it still works.
Yeah.
It still works to see somebody, oh, she's nice. She knows him by name. They've talked before, you know, she sees them as real people and it's still effective for helping us again, build some sympathy and some connection for Barbara. And then contrast it with this guy they just immediately put the sleaze bags on here.
Yeah. I think it's a good contrast to show who she was before the stone and who she becomes after it.
Mm-hmm. This also, to me, I have to read it as like 80s style. Like the guy is just creep, creep, creep through and through. Like no nuance to it. He just is a straight creep off of the bench.
Yeah.
But I also feel, I mean, I'm not an expert on the 80s, but I feel like that's also kind of 80s. You'll just have, if a guy is a creep, they just make him a creep. Like,
yep.
And then, oh, Diana happens to be there. Whoa.
Diana really should have walked her home anyway. Because yeah. Nobody's going to mess with Diana, but Barbara was walking home by herself. She shouldn't have been doing that.
Self-defense class sent them all the way across the sidewalk. Yeah, so that gives another little thing here of Barbara can kind of see the strength in Diana and sort of be a little bit envious of, oh, wow, Diana has that kind of alpha power.
But she doesn't. But Barbara doesn't go home.
No, nope, that's right.
This is the same night, the same incident. So she's going back into the Smithsonian by herself. Nobody else is there. I can't tell you how negative this is for me in terms of museum portrayal. I guess people could go in there. Maybe she could be doing some research, but this seems very, very shady.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they wanted to have it in close proximity to that. The sidewalk scene that just happened is that, you know, she's been seeing Diana. She's been getting to know Diana a little bit more. Then she sees Diana in that moment handling herself and handling that guy. And so then I think they wanted to have that go right into the wish, like while she's still on that adrenaline and having seen that.
Yeah, she has the same, telegraphed the same thing with the wish where a little breeze goes through her hair and it's very specific in what she says that she wants to be like Diana. She wants to be special. Diana's living at the Watergate Hotel. Yes.
Oh, is it really?
I think it is.
Interesting.
Which sends off a lot of connotations of American history and what does that mean for truth and the lesson she's learning here. But it could just be it's an iconic hotel and
yeah,
they wanted to do.
But it could also be a slight little nod to again some of the mankind in the 70s and into the 80s being a little bit too ambitious or a little bit too like the ends justify the means, like we'll do what we want because we want to get to a certain point, whether that means breaking in and stealing stuff or whether that means looking for shortcuts or
I think it could, if you wanted to read it that way, you could throw it back to that shortcuts sort of cheating to win sort of thing that's going throughout the movie.
So she doesn't want to look like she's wearing the same clothes, but then it actually helps her move into her new persona. Oh, look at that agility.
And I think it also, you know, because Diana is beautiful and she has a style to her. And I think now Barbara is sort of, she wants to be like Diana. So I think in her clothing and even in her hair, I think she's starting to embody that as well.
Mm-hmm. But sort of without even realizing or not doing it on purpose, it's just starting to happen because of the wish. All right. Now, I haven't seen this for a while either, but I do remember that I liked Pedro Pascal.
Well, he's hard not to like. I mean,
I felt like he had fun with this role. Like, yeah. He sunk his teeth into it.
Life is good, but it can be better. I guess that really summarizes the entire premise of what this stone can do and what these characters, the choices they're making.
Yeah, and the 80s, always it being that decade of sort of always more and more, like kind of going over the top with things.
Yeah.
Even if it's good, it can still be better, like accumulation. So I do see the logic behind setting this in the 80s and sort of like that's the story that Patty Jenkins wanted to tell or, you know, with Jeff Johns or something. It's not always, it didn't work for everybody and it's going to get to some parts that are even tough for me. I love that thumbs up though. Just coming around the way he walks and just gives this thumbs up to the guy.
Well, he has to act like he's there. Like there's a reason for him being there.
Yeah.
To try to cover up the actual reason he's there.
Yeah. Yep. So there. Yep. And he puts back on the mask of like the friendly, smiley guy. But he saw what he wanted for a second. And what he wants it, he's going to get it.
I think this is a departure from Maxwell Lord in the comics. He's usually a businessman. Yeah. But
I always successful one, not kind of a shady one.
I always associate him with WGBS in the comics. So
yeah.
So this is a slightly different take on Maxwell Lord.
Yeah. And again, for me, it's kind of like audience members can choose how much of a stickler they want to be for quote unquote comic accuracy or not. Right. I have a very wide strike zone of like, yep, you can take a character, try different things with them. Plus, even the comics themselves will have multiple versions of characters. And
true.
I feel like it's just banging your head against the wall to try to expect everything to adhere to a certain version that is somebody's, you know, one favorite version or something.
I think as long as he's like a somewhat evil businessman, I think you're in yep. the in that
yep.
strike
there zone. Has, yeah. Yeah. There has to be some greed there. There has to be, yeah. some profit motive or trying to get on top. It's just that this one has not actually become successful yet. He's just trying to put on a show of being successful. I feel like I just enjoy all of his scenes in this movie.
He is actually really selling it. Like he's trying to really go for it. And I think with his manipulation of Barbara's getting a little more confident. She's getting, like you mentioned, Diana is very confident. I think she's starting to get that way.
Mm-hmm. But he also kind of pegged Barbara as somebody that he could play for this. Like, he's like, I bet you I can kind of wrap her around my finger or something.
Yeah, he is not genuinely interested in her. He's only interested in her for what she can do for him.
Yeah, and he could have some sort of sense that she is wanting that approval or wanting that connection, so he can use that to his advantage. This to me was good the first time I watched it, where I was also thinking, oh, he's probably very successful. He's probably going to some big thing. And I thought this was a nice reveal of as the facade falls away here in a little bit. I thought that was done pretty well.
Yeah.
So again, at this point, it still all looks good, right?
Yeah, everything's like gold and big and clean.
Mm-hmm. Seems like, you know, people working for him. And yeah, there's a little crack in the facade there.
Yeah, he seems like a boss who has assistants and everyone answers to him.
So there's a little foreshadowing of Middle Eastern connection that we'll have. Final demand. So now we see, so his face cracked a little bit in the elevator. Now we see in the mail, oh, it's not actually all good news in the mail. And now, okay, this is looking a little different.
Yeah, it's a good contrast to the big spaces, and it's all clean and proper, and there's gold everywhere. Then you go into this big room where it's messy. There's stuff everywhere. It's kind of bluish, not as gold. Looks a little run down and darker. So that's a good contrast.
Yeah, and as an audience, you also have to process a few things. Like at this, like the same moment that we realize, oh, wait a minute, he's maybe not as successful as we thought, and we see how bad this area looks, empty. And that same moment that we're processing that, we also have the kid come in, and we have to also process like, oh, he's got family dynamics and he's, you know, trying to, you know, put on a good face for his son and stuff too at the same moment. So we get hit with two pieces of new information, like right at the same time as an audience. I did think having the villain with a sympathetic child kind of character was a good choice, bringing a different kind of dimension to the villain than I remember seeing in any other comic book movie. Like, I can't think of one where there's this like parent child loving relationship that sort of pulls at your heartstrings for the villain in other movies.
I think it's a good idea, but we'll talk about it, I guess, when we get towards the end of the film. But the fact that there are no consequences to his actions is very frustrating for me. You know, almost destroying the world and then getting away with it is something that I don't personally care for.
No, that's probably fair. I think maybe it's just the creative choice of trying to put this child dynamic in with the villain is an interesting challenge to try to work with in the movie.
I think it does give him a motive for why he does what he does. But then I think it also gives him an emotional center point, because he can, if he didn't have that child, he would just go nuts. But I mm-hmm. think the fact that he does have a son, I think it does bring him back down to earth a little bit. So I do think it emotionally, it's a very good choice. I just, you know, I think.
But then you have to carry it all the way to the end and make it kind of work all the way to the end. Yeah,
yeah. I think people who do bad things should get punished for them, or at least face consequences.
And the other guy calling him out and him sort of not wanting to be a failure, to me, it's going to make it interesting to follow later on, where we're now going to see how does Maxwell Lord walk this line of trying to present himself as a success. But that guy pretty much laid into him and sort of called him out in front of his kid. To me, it's an interesting villain setup, where it's not just a villain who is going to have some scheme. It's like, this villain right now has these complexities around him. He wants to be successful. He's trying to put up a successful face. He has a kid that he's trying to manage. He has some sort of broken family. We're not exactly sure the details. And then he has this guy calling him out. We can talk about how it's executed later to the end. And I kind of agree with a lot of your points. But in terms of setting it up, I feel like they have started things off with a pretty interesting sort of villain situation.
And it's almost because of the introduction of the son. It's not so much, I guess, in some ways that he's doing what he's doing for his selfish needs or wants. But I think part of it is that he's doing it because he wants to prove to his son that he's not a loser, that he is something. He wants to make his son proud of him. And so I think that's also a nice little motivation for him.
Mm-hmm. All right. So Diana's got Max Lord. Okay. Oh, wow. Those are.
Yeah. Barbara's getting a lot more confident because that shoe choice is something else. I could not wear those for 2 minutes. So the fact that she is moving to those shoes and that dress that is skin tight, she has got the confidence of Diana Prince.
And this is also one of two callbacks to the, you know, the fashion trying out outfits from the first movie, which was a big hit kind of scene. So now that's like, okay, we're going to have Barbara kind of trying on an outfit and getting the reaction like that. And then later we'll have Steve Trevor doing his spin in front of the mirrors kind of thing.
This is the only sequence I think in the movie, in addition to the shopping mall, where it ramps up the 80s a little bit. Okay. So I like that. You can hear it in the music, in the dress, in the clothing.
Yeah. And she's like, nope.
Yeah. Even down to your point with the guy who attacks Barbara, but like the sleaziness of the dudes, that is very much an 80s movie trope. So seeing that here as well at this party.
And it's also something, if you come to a Wonder Woman movie, you got to know, like, the guys are not all going to look good in this movie. There's going to be some revealing aspects of some of the worst behaviors and characteristics of men are going to come out. And if you can't handle it, then you probably can't handle a Wonder Woman movie.
Well, and that's also something that I think Wonder Woman would have to deal with, because she comes from an island of all women, and then she has to go to man's world and experience how men are. So I think that's a good thing to actually include.
Yeah.
Barbara no longer has her glasses on.
Yeah.
I guess she's like Diana in that she probably has perfect vision now.
So she's still herself in there, but she's got, you know, some new confidence brewing around herself.
Ooh, those are two good lines there. Makes you reverse the clock. and the limitations of nature. I think that's very fitting for this movie because there's a reversing of the clock with Steve Trevor, and there's also a reversing of the clock that's going to happen at the end when Maxwell Lord sort of everything sort of rewinds and undoes all of the things he did. And the limitations of nature is playing into this mystical stone that gives them all their wishes and, you know, everything is magical.
But also, isn't he basically offering sort of a shortcut? Like here's a product that will basically be a shortcut to like keeping youthful skin, or like that's like. So I think it also goes into that theme of be wary or be skeptical of shortcuts. That's not really the truth, you know, or that's not the way to get to what you're wanting.
That's
to try to find
some
shortcut thing. But he's basically trying to sell shortcuts, sort of like shortcut to get rich, or a shortcut to stay young, or shortcut to look good, or something like that. They're both good. They're both good in these interactions.
Yes, Barbara says I shouldn't let it go out of the museum. That is correct. She shouldn't do that.
That's kind of very very much the case. In fact, it probably shouldn't have even just been sitting out there haphazard.
It really kind of shouldn't have just been sitting out in her office like that.
Especially because it's one that's like not identified, right? So it's not even a known item that's laying around. It's one that they're actually trying to investigate that's laying around.
Yeah, it's probably something that should be handled a little more carefully.
Mm-hmm. Another. She just can brush them aside like nothing.
It probably happens to her all the time.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Oh, wow.
So this and all is of nice. That this is setting up the fact that there's this man following.
Yeah, this is like the third or the fourth one. And now it's something different about him. Oh, callback.
That's probably also why the I Wish We Had More Time is not only a callback to the first Wonder Woman movie, but also his watch that we saw earlier that kind of had a little twinkle to it. And then he's handing her a watch.
And his voice is already Chris Pine's voice, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just that she doesn't recognize his internal soul or something yet.
And they're reiterating that same dialogue.
Yeah. So I know that they were really praised for their chemistry in the first movie, and audiences like ate it up and stuff. I wonder at what point they decided, Patty Jenkins or Jeff Johns or whatever, or Chris Pine and Gal, like at what point they decided, oh, we're definitely bringing Steve back. Because it seemed like in the first movie, they were like, no, he is going to die. And that's going to be sort of the end of the movie. And I wonder how early on they're like, oh, we're bringing him back.
Yeah, well, I think I don't know if like the contracts make them beholden to that kind of thing where they sign like a 3-picture deal or something. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, we got to bring him back somehow because
we've got him anyway. It's kind of one of those things where, again, I feel like it's in the choice of the audience. If you want to just be mad about it and be like, he should have stayed dead. His death is more meaningful if he stays dead. You can be upset about that this whole movie if you want. Or you can just kind of go with it and be like, all right, the creative team and Chris Pine and stuff, they're bringing him back. Let's see what they do with it. Let's see where they go with it.
Yeah, I guess that's sort of me. I would have preferred him to stay dead as that.
I was fine if he stayed dead. Like, yeah. I was fine if it's like that movie was great and he can be there in the history books. But
I can see that there's, you know, maybe a lesson that you could teach Diana through this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have been fine with him staying dead. But then I'm also like, well, if I want to try to enjoy life and enjoy movies, then I have to give them a little bit of a chance to see what they do with it or something like that.
Yeah. If you don't give it a shot, you'll never be able to have the ability to critique it. You might as well watch it all the way through. I do think it's interesting here that Diana's wearing all white and Steve Trevor, or the guy who looks like Steve Trevor at the moment, he's got a white t-shirt on.
Yeah.
I don't know what to make of that exactly, but I mean, there's an intentional choice behind that.
Yeah. And they have them in a dark scene. So they definitely chose that specifically. The sliver of white on Steve, but Yeah, he would be impressed by the jetliners there.
And I guess it is compatible with the white of the Lincoln Memorial there.
Mm-hmm. I like it when movies have a clear sense of place, you know, so we've gotten several different clear connections to DC that we know that that's, you know, where they are. And
I think it's a it's an interesting place to put Diana Prince, to put Wonder Woman in a place where government is. She is, I think, mostly in Washington, D.C. in the Wonder Woman TV series where she works with the military.
Right, that's right.
So yeah. I think it's very character correct for her to be there at some point in her career.
Right. And it also kind of, I mean, they don't do a lot with, you know, the American government. I mean, a little bit, but, you know, in the first Wonder Woman movie, she goes to the British leadership, right to like the British governmental leaders, military leaders, and speaks her mind there. So now you kind of put her in the center of American government, and that will come into play a little bit later. So there's some continuity or parallelism there.
Yeah, and I guess she's not overtly a representative of Themyscira to the you know, to man's world, but in some ways that is what she is, even if she's not telling people that's what she's doing there. But I think it fits her character.
Yeah. Was it an 80s thing to have aquariums like that, like in the wall?
I'm sure. I mean, that's still something that happens today. I mean, aquariums can be very big depending on how much money you have, but yeah, I can buy that.
The wall looks kind of 80s-ish.
The
texture of the wall there.
Yeah, and having a lot of plants like that. Oh, there's an old Mountain Dew, a liter of Mountain Dew over there. That's a very specific thing to put in there. I'd have to check and see the Mountain Dew logo from the 1980s, see if it's accurate.
So this has given us a little bit of moment to acclimate to the fact that Steve's back, but in this dude's body. So let the audience kind of catch up to this here.
Yeah, they have to really spell it out to us how this is happening, because he is dead. So we have to understand why this is happening. Just as an update, I think that Mountain Dew logo was correct for the
1980s. Oh, nice.
I did look it up.
Cool. So
good attention to detail. It's not very prominent in the shot, but
right. There's probably a lot of production design folks that had to do a lot of 80s research and finding things.
Which I bet was pretty fun.
All right, back to Max. So he goes right away to this kind of meta wish. Like, you know, he doesn't just have a wish. He's wishing about the wishing. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if he thought it through. Did he like strategize about what he was going to ask it?
Yeah. I took it as he's been thinking about this for a while and he's like, this is the wish I'm going to try. And I guess it's fine, because it's like, if that wish doesn't work, he still has the stone and he can just make another wish. So it's sort of worth a shot, I guess.
Well, but the stone deteriorated.
But I mean, if he tried to wish to become the wishmaker and the stone was just like, doesn't work, you know, I'm assuming the stone would have just been like, nope, try again.
Yeah.
But it did work, you know, so then because it worked, it disintegrates.
Now he's in a little bit of trouble because he can't like unwish it, I guess. I don't know. I guess we'll have to see. I can't remember how that pans out, but we do see that Barbara has gotten Diana's strength now.
Yep, that's all.
So things are slowly, it seems that the Dreamstone doesn't seem to have the effects right away.
Right, kind of gradually, slowly. Yep, takes on more and more of the wish. If you have a more complex wish, I think it just, it takes a while to take full effect. So there's questions about the bodily rights of this man who's occupied currently.
Right. That is a little controversial.
Yeah.
With good reason to be.
I don't think they ever address it really. They're just like, don't worry about it. Don't think about it too much.
It is something to think about how Steve Trevor in some way is in there. We see his outward appearance, but realistically, it's that other guy, but Diana sees him as Steve Trevor. But I'm trying to rationalize it as the Steve Trevor who was dead has now somehow come back to life, or it's just mm-hmm. his essence or something. Trying to figure that out to really nail down what that is.
Yeah. It's difficult. 80s gym here.
Oh yeah, look at those leggings. Those short shorts on those guys, those tall socks.
I think this is pretty good by Kristen Wiig to show like even she is surprised by what she's able to do right now.
Well, because she didn't know that Diana was Wonder Woman. So right. for her yeah. to wish that she wanted to be more like Diana, this is becoming a surprise.
Yep. Yep.
Those big dudes behind her are very shocked. I like the look at that. 1980s yeah. computers.
I know. I was just thinking the same thing. Yep.
We've come a long way.
So this is a nice little quick turning of the tables, you know, just from a few minutes ago, he was dressing down Max Lord there and now turns around here real quick, but.
He's mentioning the truth here.
Yeah. And it's filling in a little bit more of where Max was before this.
He's talking about wanting to wish for better. Mm-hmm. Life is good, but it can be better. A lot of wish talk here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is this insinuation that they have to be touching him, that they have to
touch
as if they were holding the Dreamstone.
Yeah, touching him, and he did get him to phrase it as a wish, like explicitly as a wish.
I think they're fairly, we'll have to track it throughout the movie, but I think that's pretty consistent in how they depict it, but we'll have to track mm-hmm. it.
And I feel like that could be a Geoff Johns sort of fingerprint on the movie, is I feel like Geoff Johns usually does, if he has a mechanism for how it works, that he will try to be pretty consistent on like how it plays out in the story.
Yeah. Set up a rule and stick with it is a pretty good way to go about it. I wonder if he went to him as just like a test, like almost like he, I know he wanted some revenge, but I wonder if he wanted to see if it would work. On somebody.
He does. Right. Pet. When he sees that, he does seem like a little bit like, whoa, it's actually happening. Like he's kind of like, this is working. Okay, here we go. This was. So first movie, Diana comes to Man's World, gets to try some different outfits on. To humorous effect, and now we get to have Steve trying on some.
And she's the one now who is the person who is very plugged into the world and what people wear, and he's sort of the outsider, the fish out of water.
Yeah, I think that was probably one of the big concepts of this movie, is we'll have Steve be the one that doesn't know the world and is kind of awestruck about what's going on, whereas Diana was that way in the first movie.
I really like that American flag fanny pack.
It is nice how he brings it around. Right? Good comedic timing.
And I think it's fitting for Steve Trevor, who was a pilot for, I guess, the American military, but I think he worked mostly with the English in World War One.
Yeah. And even the scarves, too, would be a thing for like the World War One pilots. They would have scarves on to make sure their neck didn't chafe when they were looking up and down and around and stuff.
I mean, Chris Pine is pretty good in that scene.
Yeah. And it harkens back to just those two actors kind of playing off each other and having a good time with their scenes.
I do like the use of the escalators here, because if you go to Washington, D.C., there are a lot of trains that you can use to go to the Washington Mall, things like that. So I like the mm-hmm. incorporation of things in Washington, D.C. that you can actually go and do.
Yeah. And then he gets to have this like amazed kind of reaction like Diana did in the first movie.
Well, if you did exist in 1918, this would be totally mm-hmm. foreign for you.
Yeah, it'd be amazing. And yeah, these things would be
the hairstyles.
Surprising. Yeah.
But yeah, this subway is very indicative of DC, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
A subway would be totally foreign for him. He would have known what a train was, I think, but a subway train is very different. The music here is interesting, though. This, like, classical piece. I don't know what this is.
Yeah, the music they're dancing to is very, very low. And then there is this, like, opera singer kind of over the top for some reason.
Yeah. I'm curious about the choice for that. There's got to be a reason that they've plugged this track in there. The trash can thing always, I've been asking myself the question, what is art? I've been trying to answer that for myself.
Yeah.
And so I think about things like that a lot, where someone could look at trash and think it's art, and why would it not be art?
I mean, the choice of the trash can design still does kind of set a visual tone for the space that you're in and stuff. I mean,
true.
It's kind of like people don't expect art out of it, but it is still actually coloring the space and giving shape to the space that you're in. So in that sense, it's still serving some functions of art.
I suppose so.
Or it could be art if it's more art is in how the people take it in, I guess.
Yeah, is art what you experience from something? I don't know. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out. I like that they go to the Air and Space Museum, though. I think that's very fitting for Steve Trevor.
Yeah, yeah, that's nice. All right, so now he's back to his place here. Oh, yeah, lots of phones ringing here. I think it's dawning on him, like, oh, it's really happening here. Bless her heart, she's trying her best.
Yeah, if I wonder what this would look like nowadays if you were by yourself trying to answer all these phones. Would there be a better way to do it than just running around the office? Yeah, he's got to touch her and she's got to do the wish, and there's blowing of the hair.
Yep. Yeah.
This wish goes a little quicker, though.
I was going to say, that one was very quick. Like, he had to have already been walking around the corner or something.
Yep. These people are starting to show up pretty quickly. He's having a little bit of a consequence, though.
Yeah, you can kind of see. Then you sort of just wonder, okay, does it take a little bit of a toll to have this happening? Yeah, there's a little hint.
As it should. It should take a toll if you become a magical dreamstone that can get you whatever you want.
Now she's the center of attention here.
Yep, just like Diana probably would have been.
Did Steve just do a total look up and down? I didn't notice that.
I mean, maybe. But I think that would actually make sense, because if Barbara is now her new confident self, who is like Diana, who wanted to be Diana, I could see why Steve maybe would have been maybe interested in doing that.
Diana's the one that's still, she's still seen clearly, like, on, Diana has her eye on, like, what's important right now. Barbara's getting swept up in her stuff. Max Lord is getting swept up in his stuff. Steve is, like, astounded by the world and stuff. Diana's the one that has the clarity of, like, what's going on here? Like, where's that object? Like,
yeah, she is somewhat still grounded in that. She's enjoying having Steve back, but I think she can still understand the significance of what's going on.
Yeah.
And Barbara here is wearing black. She's wearing black at the party. She's wearing black here. I know probably people might think that that's stereotypical or too much of a trope to have villains in black, but I like it.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, what does Steve know about anything in the plot? Nothing, right? He's like, he hasn't been clued into what Diana suspects is going on or anything. He's just with Diana.
But he knows who she is and what she's capable of.
Right.
He does, but I mean, he doesn't. Memories.
Yeah. But Steve doesn't know anything about the Dreamstone or anything.
Oh, yet, right. Or, yeah.
I guess maybe she could have filled him in a little bit at this point now off screen or something, but. Yeah, Diana's now, she's like, something's going on. She's got to get to the bottom of it here.
But do you think that Diana has suspected that Barbara has used the Dreamstone?
I didn't pick up anything of her. Well, yeah, I didn't pick up anything of her being like suspicious of Barbara herself. I think she is just really worried about where did that stone go. She knows that there's probably something important about that.
Yeah, I don't think she knows, but.
And I don't think she realizes at all how Steve has come back. She's just sort of like, she's so happy that it's happened. She didn't really interrogate, like, why did this happen? How did it happen?
Yeah.
But now she's kind of on the case of like, wait a minute, where is that stone? Like, so now she might start to be putting
so many coincidences. He has images of that Dreamstone all over his office, and he's become a big success now. And she probably recognizes that writing.
Yep. There. Now she can see the interior writing. And this is good, too, because Steve is about the only person that would actually believe her when she says that, because he knows that she does have some connection there.
Yeah, it would make a difference which god wrote it, depending on which of the gods it was.
Yep, because now she's like, wait a minute. Could be a lot of other, like, the history of the gods, their interactions and stuff, you know, could have been a lot of other parts of this world that could have been explored, but that will not happen. Or at least not in this universe.
Yeah, I like the idea of having some kind of connection to the gods, because Diana is a demigoddess, I guess, herself. So she would have knowledge of these things and know the significance of what's going on.
Yeah. When I first heard that Steve Trevor was coming back, you know, I kind of heard it as a rumor first about it, that Chris Pine was like, you know, going to be involved in the sequel and stuff. Before we knew anything about the movie or anything, I thought there might be something with like Hades, like Diana somehow going down to the land of the dead souls and like somehow bringing him back or something, connecting into the, you know, they had Ares, they'd had Zeus, they'd had the story from, you know, the first movie. So I thought maybe they would tap into it that way. But
that would have worked. I would have bought into that totally.
But that's not 80s connected. It would have been more. No. That. So to me, that was one thing where I'm like, it's a little bit of a stretch. Like, just because he was a pilot, I'm not sure that he could operate a plane with 70-year more modern technology.
That's a little bit of a stretch as well. But this is when I was talking about some of the things I thought the movie did well, I think this sequence is one of them. So I think the incorporation of this plane with the Air and Space Museum from Washington, D.C., and the connection to Steve as a pilot, and also then the connection of how that informs Diana's ability later on in the movie and what she learns from Steve about how to fly. I think all of this is really good.
Yeah, and it might be part of what the creative team sort of felt like this will work, because when they realized, oh yeah, if we go to DC, we can have these connections to air and space and that kind of stuff. So they might, once they started realizing some of those connections could happen, they'll be like, okay, this is a good idea. Even like Steve being the one out of place and then being able to make these connections they might have started to feel like this is the way to go with the sequel.
And I really applaud the effort to incorporate the invisible jet, because it is a silly thing. It is a silly concept. And to be able to do it in such a real world take on the character of Wonder Woman, which it is. I mean, the DCEU was meant to be like, what if the DC superheroes really lived in our world? And so mm-hmm. you have something so fantastical and silly actually kind of makes sense in this real world, I thought was actually very clever. Now, the incorporation of Diana being the one to make it invisible was a stretch for me, because we had not seen that previously.
Yeah.
So to having to buy into this new ability is something I struggled with, but I like the idea of this.
Yeah. And there's also quite a few movies where the sequel, they add a little bit to the power repertoire of the hero. So that's not unheard of. I'm also trying to think about how can I sort of headcanon this for him to be able to fly such a more modern plane. I think he mentioned that the body that he's inhabiting was maybe some kind of engineer.
Oh yeah.
So it's not the same as pilot, but maybe the person whose body he's inhabiting has some mechanical ability or some, you know, it maybe has some awareness of this technology. And so maybe because he's in his body, maybe he gets some of the brain waves and, you know, cerebral connections that maybe he can tap into it when
you can maybe, I think, get that out of that. But then is there a flip side to that? Does the guy whose body he's inhabiting also get the memories of Steve by the end of it? I don't know.
Yeah, afterward, that would be interesting. I feel like Steve knows the principles of flight. And then maybe the other dude has a little bit of the knowledge of like current technology, and maybe put those together, he can make it work in a crisis or something.
I could maybe buy that. We'll go with that.
I said I was going to try to be positive and fine.
There are a lot more buttons probably than he was used to in 1980.
Here we go. So Diana touches the dashboard very intently, and
she
makes
it
disappear. Although people saw, they saw it in the process of going invisible.
That was really good, though, that they removed all the sound effects and all the sound as it.
Right, it goes stealthy and invisible.
That was good. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So apparently if she touches it and concentrates, she can just make it invisible.
And I'm trying to remember from Wonder Woman 2017, they never fly together, do they?
No, I don't think. No, I don't think she's ever on a plane.
And Diana. Yeah. So from a character and a relationship perspective, I like the idea that this is sort of like them having this sort of romantic date where they get to actually experience this together, and she's getting to see his ability. You know, he mm-hmm. witnessed all of her Wonder Woman super feats and all that kind of thing, but here she is getting to experience what he's good at. So I like the idea that they're kind of experiencing
something
from another perspective.
Right. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but that is a nice turning of the tables. In addition to the fashion stuff and the wonder about the world, now it's also seeing a little bit of, like you said, what he's able to do.
And flying through fireworks is just, that's really visually romantic.
Yeah. Yeah, the lights and then the fireworks to punctuate it.
Yeah. And the music is soaring and gives me goosebumps a little bit. So I think this is a very, very good scene in terms of what they're trying to accomplish here, where they're trying to make it mm-hmm. romantic and make you feel things.
Yep. And, you know, she's started to get on the case of, like, you know, the plot, the main plot, but it's not so far along that you can't have this little detour. Like, to me, it's still early enough that she can have this little respite with her boyfriend here and take it in.
And this is also helping them accomplish their investigation, because they have to get somewhere else.
Yep, so they had to do that anyway.
So they have to fly anyway. So this is just a way to tackle a lot of things at once. I used to, I can't remember who I heard it from, but somebody I listened to one time about screenwriting said that every scene should accomplish more than one thing. So right. I think this scene does several things in that way. Mm-hmm. And it also gives Diana a chance to experience flight that she had not experienced before.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to feel that feeling of what it would be like up there I think will inform her later.
Yeah, and here she verbalizes some of that. And now this yep can give her some inspiration to try to start to understand it better, and then that can play into the later part.
It's good for her to learn from a skilled pilot. So mm-hmm. I think if she had to learn how to fly from somebody, I'm glad it was Steve. I guess she could have learned how to fly theoretically from like Superman, but but she didn't know Superman at this point. So
right.
So I'm glad it was Steve.
Yeah.
Ah, right. Microfilm.
Yep. And we got a little change in the music here. Awesome.
And the color grading is noticeably cooler and bluer.
Like in contrast to the fireworks that we just saw, like with all the colors. Yeah, yeah.
And that also, to me, like dictates a more sterile environment. She's in a place. I guess she's still in the museum. Maybe she's still in the collections or something where it's no windows, you know, that kind of thing. Versus here, she's outside and it's warmer. There's golden tones. Now she's about to like experience her superpowers. So I like the color grading here. She's still in black, by the way.
I've lost count of the creepy guys that just have to make her look.
I think this is the same creepy guy, though.
That one is, but even the guy before, I said something that she looks good or something. So it's like, But yeah, this one is, I think, the same dude.
Well, her problem, Sam, is that she keeps going out really late at night. You're gonna encounter the creepy guys late at night.
Yeah. But this is a nice... So Maxwell Lord had his comeuppance turning the tables on that other business dude, and now she's gonna have to turn the tables on this guy.
Both using their powers. They're different powers, but they're both utilizing their newfound powers.
No means no, dude.
There has been no downside for Barbara so far.
Right.
She is still really enjoying this. I like this music, this musical cue for her, for Cheetah. Like her, I would think that this is her musical theme with the horns.
Yeah.
Going a little chaotic.
Right. It's a strong theme, but it also has a little edge to it's a little bit disconcerting edge to the music.
It's almost, I don't know if jungly is an adjective, but if she's a cheetah, if she's animalistic in some ways, I kind of feel like that's the way the horns are used there. I could hear that being like a call in the jungle in some way, if I was really going to stretch that out to try to tie that back to the cheetah part of her.
Yep. And here, kind of like a little bit like a cat playing with its prey a little bit. Stalking it now as she was creeping up on it or walking up on him that time. Now, the other dude that we saw earlier,
the nice guy.
A little bit of a reminder of the nice side of what she used to be, but she's
fallen a little bit.
Yeah,
she was mean to even that guy, to Leon.
Yeah, a little curt with him too. Yeah. Okay, change of setting here. The plane's arriving. So we've got the water and the green inside the desert here.
Mm-hmm.
Shows some of the wealth of this gentleman.
He's also in a high place where he can oversee, you know, his metaphorical kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, his journey to self-fulfillment. That would explain his entire arc.
Yeah, and he might have taken a little bit of a shortcut in that journey.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's got to touch him. Got to be specific about that.
Yeah, so that one doesn't work.
Now that's very specific.
but a big wish too. Like, it's big, but specific.
Yeah.
It's not just a temporary help coming around the corner.
Now, I wonder if with Maxwell's power, is it effortless? Does it just come out of him, or is he doing something to make it happen?
So,
or does the Dreamstone just, when the word wish happens, it just goes through him?
I take it as it just sort of happens in the universe as long as, you know, the touching and the wishing happens.
Yeah.
I don't see him having to, like, manipulate it or, like, over, you know, pull the strings on it or anything. I feel like it just, universe starts to take over once the wish is made. So that's how I've interpreted it.
Yeah, it's like if you do these certain things, it will just enact on its own.
All right. So he wished for his ancestral lands to be returned to him. But Max is taking his security team.
Yeah, so Maxwell is not just wanting to be successful. Now he's accumulating power. Starting to get a little worse, I think.
And what brings us here is the oil connection. So he had the oil plots in the U.S. and now he's kind of making a move on the oil stuff over here too as well, right?
He's manipulated this guy into taking things. This is a bigger, more physical wish as well. It's affecting a location with people around, and this is starting to really escalate into something more than just like,
yeah,
I want to be successful, or I want to have money, or I want to be special. This is like now
changing world events.
Yeah. You're changing the landscape of a place, and that can have a lot more serious consequences to it. Yeah. Okay. So this is really interesting for me, because I have not been like paying attention to this the previous times I've watched this, but now Diana and Steve are both wearing white.
It
could be indicative that, they're in the desert. Maybe they wear the white to be cooler, so that it's not so hot. But I just think that's really interesting to sort of track that trajectory.
Yeah, there's definitely been something with the very stark whites and the very dark blacks has definitely been going on. So she's just stared them down. That's her plan at this point. All right, another. So we've had one Wonder Woman action set piece, right, which was the mall scene so far. So this is the second action piece. Is that right?
I'm trying to think. She had a little bit of saving Barbara.
Yeah, just a little move, but not. Yeah.
But yeah, this is a bigger one.
Yeah.
And it's more specifically like a Wonder Woman sequence. She's putting on the tiara.
Yep. And she's got the outfit on.
So do we think that's just on her, or is she like twirling in the car, do we think?
I didn't see any twirl or room to twirl. But maybe. I also didn't see it under the white clothing. I think we would have seen it.
Maybe it's some sort of magical thing. She can like speak it into existence somehow. I don't really know how that works.
Yeah, they pretty much just had her changed when she went out of the car. So they took away her sword. So I was like, we were talking in the mall that based on the threat level and stuff, what was going on. Oh, that's a nice little lassoing the bullet. Mm-hmm. There's a friend of mine named RJ Casey who wrote like an independent comic book about a Western hero. And it has in the opening scene, it has the Western hero lasso a bullet out of the air, just like cool. That. He did it before this movie. But yeah, nice use of the lasso, I guess. So, but in the mall scene, it makes sense that she wouldn't need a sword. Like, she's in a mall and she's just kind of protecting some people and then apprehending the robbers. But this one, it seems like a sword might have been appropriate. Like, she's got gunfire coming in at her. And
You could have used it to take out the tires.
Yeah.
And stop them from moving.
But it was a... I know Patty Jenkins talked about it. I can't remember now. It was a few years ago. But, like, she said it was a specific decision by Patty Jenkins, I think, mainly to go with the lasso as a more peaceful weapon rather than the sword, which is a more, you know, violent weapon. But in sometimes, like, sword or her shield might have been helpful here.
I mean, she's still a warrior. I don't think that's... You can still use the sword in a peaceful way that doesn't harm anybody or kill anybody. But that's Patty Jenkins's take on the character. You know, Zack Snyder's mm-hmm. take on it is she's more of a warrior, and so she would have no sword. She's a god killer. But Patty Jenkins here chooses to use the lasso. And I think the lasso stuff is really cool, but does it always make total sense? Not really. But it is cool looking.
I like the lasso, but yeah, it just seemed like they limited her a little bit. But then the other way that's nice little truck flip. Oh, and then she comes up over the top of it. So a little bit different than
that's
the Dark Knight.
That's a cool visual of her coming up out of the truck.
Yep. And thinking about it too, like the people that she's dealing with are largely people that are under the influence of some of the wishing and that kind of thing. So like for most of the movie, she doesn't want to have any threat of lethal force. She's just trying to actually handle the situation. But in this one, she's directly getting fired on. It sort of seems like she could have had a little bit more self-defense.
I mean, if it was me, I would just slash everybody's tires. They're not going to go anywhere after that. Because the whole time she's working to stop them from moving.
Yeah.
But I guess if you do that, you don't get a cool sequence of Wonder Woman with tanks.
And also, so she lost a little bit of her power when she made her wish too, right? So she gradually shows a little bit of vulnerability, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, she's bleeding.
Yeah.
How often do we see Wonder Woman bleed?
Mm-hmm. Get to save some more kids.
This is also why I think the lasso can come into play here. Yeah, she uses the lasso
She hitches a ride. So she just needed it for the ride, and then she sends it off harmlessly to the side. Yeah.
Yep. And I do like this visual of her swooping down to save those kids.
Oh yeah. See, she is losing a little bit of her.
Yeah.
A bit of her touch. Nice of them to stop.
you would think they would just run her over.
because of the kids, but like, yeah, they were shooting directly at her with big guns, and now they're like, oh, want to make sure we don't hit you.
Yeah. Yeah, he's Maxwell Lord is experiencing another headache.
Yeah.
I can't remember if Barbara has instances like that where something affects her. I guess maybe because he is the Dreamstone now, it's taking more out of him.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Barbara kind of, she doesn't weaken. Like, Barbara loses her friendliness and her kindness and that sort of thing is what she loses.
Oh, right.
Whereas what Wonder Woman loses is she loses some of her strength. And so it's kind of like, I think it depends on the person and what they wish for, that sort of, it's different for what they might lose from it. But they always do kind of give up something to get their wish. They just don't realize it at first.
Yeah, so that beautiful place where we were just moments ago has
smoke
coming out of it and helicopters flying around.
Yeah, and now you can see here this wish is definitely affecting world relations and international, you know, conflict and stuff. So the stakes are definitely ratcheted up in a big way now.
I guess that is a thing about wishes, you know, you have to really think about what you're wishing for, because you can make that wish and it could come true, but you're then not in control of what comes after it. So I like at least the movie's attempt to show that not everything is what you think it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. This phone callback is also reminding me of the first Wonder Woman movie when they call back to like at a candy or whatever to get an update and stuff. So they're even small little stuff like that. It's kind of has the parallelism from the first movie to this one.
And I like that they're working together on this. They're two museum professionals. They both have an interest in history and they both have specific fields that they probably study. And I like that they're actually trying to work together at this point.
But I think that they, I think at this point, Diana Barber, neither one realizes that they have actually been affected by the wishing kind of stuff. They're still just thinking we need to solve this because of Maxwell Lord and other stuff. I don't think they've fully processed, like, wait a minute, I'm actually tied up in this wish stuff as well.
Yeah.
I mean, if they had a moment to stop and think about it, I think they would realize it. But it's sort of like it's always boom, boom, boom. They haven't had a time to let it really sink in.
It's like, come on, Diana, don't you remember wishing for Steve Trevor to come back? And now he's back. Like, connect the dots.
Yeah.
But I guess she is preoccupied with other things. Yeah, these cheetah costumes are getting way better. I mean, the fur is great.
She has, she's had a lot of costumes or, you know, wardrobe changes so far in this movie.
She's become increasingly more punkish, more kind of, I don't want to say like anti-authority, but like it's sort of reminding me of like punk groups in the 1980s. Where they were fighting against the man or whatever. And I see her in that aesthetic. So I think she's getting a little more out of control, a little more leaning towards her villainous side. She's not as straight laced as maybe she once was.
Right. All right. So I'm going to be curious watching this time. What I remember from this scene is it seems like this scene was just plopped in here to help explain some things. And then I don't know if it ever comes back again or if it's more just like this was just an expositional requirement to get a guy in here who can explain some stuff. And I can't remember that it comes back around in any meaningful way. Like this guy, like this setting in this guy, or if it's just like, nope, exposition drop right here. A little bit more than halfway through the movie.
Yeah, I always thought it was more expositional. Ooh, the God of Lies.
God of Lies, yeah.
Aaron, that's the opposite of truth. Wishes with a trick.
I learned all about the monkey's paw from The Simpsons.
Steve says it takes away your most valued possession. Or something of that nature. Mm-hmm. That went pretty quickly. But so would Diana's most valued possession be her power? And I guess for Barbara, it would be her kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Yeah, it said you have to destroy it or you have to give back what you gained from the wish.
Mm.
Oh, you're looking at it. Yeah, a little clue. They pretty much figured it out pretty directly.
Yeah, I mean,
pretty good inferences.
They've connected all the dots now. They just needed to talk it out. See, when Steve said that the first time about what if we destroy him, I did wonder if the movie was going to have Wonder Woman kill Maxwell Lord because she does.
Oh.
Do that in the comics. So I was like, oh yeah. they're not gonna go there, but I think you could have justified it in the movie if you wanted to go that route. But I kind of thought, to be honest, I thought they were too chicken to do that. But but I think it would have been justifiable given Maxwell Lord's actions towards the end of the movie.
Maybe she thought about it, but she didn't have her sword. So then
that's true. She would have needed to have her sword in order to do that. I mean, I'm not proposing that Wonder Woman kill Maxwell Lord.
No, but you're like, trying to
given the setup that they put
right
out
trying
there
to think about how are they going to resolve it. Yeah. Yep. Now, you know, so now he's got the success, but now what comes with it is he's, you know, people are after me. People are jealous of this, and there's these downsides to the success.
And he's seemingly taking pills, or he's got bloodshot eyes.
Yep. And
things are not going well for him physically.
Yep. And that one's a tough moment, right? He says that, and then his kid actually heard it. Like, that's like, you don't even see the kid, but you just see his shadow running away, and it's like, oh man, that's tough to hear. So
I can't remember, did his office before have all this stuff in it? Like, there's a something that looks like an Ankh on the shelf, and all these like fancy, like there's an Egyptian
I feel like
pyramid.
There's way more
More things in there indicative of antiquity or things of old history. Did he accumulate that just when he became with the Dreamstone, essentially?
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to go back and look at that.
Yeah. This is interesting here too. He's kind of thinking, how can I do a lot of these at once?
I will say that is pretty evil to prey on, or P-R-E-Y, to prey on people of faith like that. That to me, that is pure evil.
Mm-hmm. He's like, how can I
people that way?
Yeah, it's kind of that susceptible audience. Can I turn it into the thing that he wants?
And now he's going after a mass of people. Like, it's not just one person anymore. It's multiple people at once.
Yeah. Now, again, he got to put the face on for his son.
He's got the leopard print there on the couch. I guess foreshadowing his connection to Cheetah. Well, he already had a connection with Barbara.
Yeah. The hair. I think the hair, you know, they've almost kind of told the story with his hair and how kind of disheveled it is. And he's trying to push it back, but it's kind of coming forward. It's like he's losing control on it.
He used to really care about it too, because he wanted to look good for TV. And when he went to the party, and it was all very coiffed and cared for. Now that he has everything he wants, his hair is the last of his concern. The son had to touch him.
I forgot about that one, yeah. So the kid wished for his greatness, because he said, I want my greatness, or my greatness is your greatness.
Should have thought that one through.
I think too, so, you know, it's Maxwell like thinks he's doing stuff and that his kid will be proud of him or whatever, but like, it seems like more the kid just wants to spend time and wants to just be with his dad. He doesn't care about all this stuff that the dad's trying to accumulate and everything.
Of course. And if the son says, I wish for your greatness, could that be interpreted a different way from when the kid, how the kid means it versus how Maxwell would mean it?
Right.
Would he want for his greatness to be like a great dad?
I think that he just goes and he's trying to get the wish. He's just playing everybody as a means to an end, and then he's like, wait a minute, you've already done your wish.
So do you think he's needing, is the Dreamstone coming through him needing to be something that gives someone a wish?
I don't know. Yeah, it's like, so he's become a master at playing people for their wishes. Clearly it's messing up the whole world, but like, yeah, I wonder, what is Maxwell's real end game? You know, like, where does he think it will all lead to and sort of reach a conclusion? It seems like he's just totally lost it.
So I'm going to have to go out and come back in just as an FYI, Sam.
Okay.
So just do the commentary by yourself, and I will try to rejoin you.
Yep, no problem.
Sorry about this.
No, it's okay. Got Steve taking his jacket off at this point. He's all right. Everything's getting pretty messy here. But yeah, I still I haven't gotten into this movie as deeply as some of the other ones, and I still like I like watching the Maxwell Lord character, but I haven't been able to totally piece together his point of view on everything and how he was expecting it all to work out. But we can go back to the Steve part, which I think I was tracking a little bit better.
Yeah, I don't know if you can still hear me, but yeah, the Steve part of it, I think, would be something to track in terms of his character and in how he helps inform Diana's progress as a character, because I think that's really what he's supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's kind of he's there voicing things to Diana, but also Diana needs to kind of realize it herself. It's kind of nice, too, that Steve is already kind of coming to terms faster with what needs to happen before Diana does. Diana doesn't want to give it up again. But I think it helps eventually that Diana knows Steve is sort of more at peace with it, and that might make it where she can kind of do what she needs to do at the end. So this is kind of going back to the start about that somberness that she had at the beginning and that loneliness, that missing. And now to have him back was, you know, brought that life and that connection back into her life. But yeah, that's got to be tough. Yeah. And for her, so I think this is meant to connect back with the competition at the beginning of the movie where she wants to win that competition. She knows what she wants. She sees how to get there, but it's like, sometimes it's not that simple. Like, yeah, you want Steve, that brings you happiness, but that doesn't mean it's that simple to get there. And that shortcut that's so enticing, that shortcut to the goal that she wants, it's not the truth. It's not like what you can actually end up with.
Yeah, I think all the characters have to deal with that in some form or fashion. Some of them handle it a little better than others, I guess.
So I know they did the setup of this armor at the beginning of the mascara. And then here's the reminder of it. And then it will like pay off later. But when it does pay off later, I'll have to try to see if I can make like a thematic connection to how it works. Because as you know, like I often try to find out, like, how does the theme bring everything together? Maybe I need to listen harder here in this part to see. Like, how does this character, like, how is she the solution to the dilemma of the movie, like the theme of the movie?
Oh, the what is her name? Archer. Asteria, I think is her name. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds right. So I get that she's, you know, this hero from the past and has this thing, but like I need to try to trace how is she the representation of the solution? Like, so they're trying to go to shortcuts. They're trying to get what they want, sort of have what they want. And so how does Asteria represent the converse of that, or the contrast to that?
Yeah, I think that's a great thing to look out for, because in the beginning, Diana's mentors talk to her. I think it's Hippolyta who talks to her about Asteria and how she would handle things better, or for a lack of better. I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that'd be good to track. Also, I'm trying to figure out the Wonder Woman or Diana wearing white a lot. I need to go back and look at it now, because does she start wearing white after she makes the wish? Is she becoming more human, or is it just...
So she definitely, she definitely had that very white dress on after she made the wish. And then that was where Steve like found her and came. So that white dress was definitely after the wish was made.
Because sure. Even wearing the jacket with like the white t-shirt underneath it, she's still.
Mm-hmm. So this is the president of the United States. Another DC connection here. For me, this part, from what happened in Egypt to here with the president, to me, that all kind of ramped up pretty fast. Like, you know, they have the looking out like, oh, stuff's going bad. Stuff is smoky and seems, you know, chaotic. But that world level kind of thing to the president level, to me, happened pretty quick.
Yes.
Like Maxwell was doing like some wishes around his office. And then all of a sudden it was Egypt. And then all of a sudden it was the president. Like, to me, those are pretty quick jumps. Where I guess technically it works, but like for me, it loses me a little bit as an audience member of like, wow, this has moved pretty fast, pretty quickly.
Well, you're getting to one of the most powerful people in the world, the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much further you can go than that to get his power. Cause I guess at this point, I'm just assuming that Maxwell, as the Dreamstone, just wants to accumulate more power and make bigger wishes as it goes.
Yeah. But it ratcheted from like 1 to 10.
Yeah, pretty quickly.
I think. Yeah.
I guess.
But I guess maybe, time. But maybe that's part of the message of it, is that it does really take, pick up speed fast when you're like, give me this, give me this. I want more. I want more. Maybe it is like exponential. Like how fast that kind of thing goes.
I guess the president's supposed to be looking sort of like Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, I got a little bit of Reagan vibes.
But I don't think it's named. Is he named?
I doubt that he's named, but he just gives some vague vibes of Reagan for the 80s. Yeah. They did the whoosh of the little breeze again.
Yep. And they had like a jar of candy, which apparently is something Ronald Reagan had.
So he kind of gets to specify what he takes from them in exchange for the wish. So it's, I think the earlier ones with the actual stone was more like it takes their strength or it takes their most precious thing. But now it seems like Maxwell's able to actually specify what he wants from the person.
I also wonder with Maxwell, how much of it, this is him controlling the situation. Mm-hmm. Is he the one who wants more power, or is the Dreamstone has it just fully taken over him?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Like, is the real villain the Dreamstone itself and what it does, and it's just operating through Maxwell? It's maybe not actually Maxwell himself. I mean, he had a little bit of, he had the seeds of it early on, but then maybe the Dreamstone is just taking advantage of that.
Yeah, has he lost control of it?
Yeah. So now he's going full on wish level. All right. Action set piece number 3, I believe, in terms of like a kind of memorable full Wonder Woman kind of sequence.
And again, this is happening in a very iconic Washington, D.C. location.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, she's definitely not tip-top shape here. Oh, so they're explicitly addressing the sword.
Yeah.
So in this case, she's kind of saying she doesn't really want to hold it against the people that are under the influence of everything going on.
I guess it does... It does leave the opportunity for some cool lasso sequences, which there are a lot of good ones in here. So I can see why they're we don't want to use the sword because it takes away from that.
Yeah, and that was a new spinning kind of visual. I was going to say that her and Aquaman could have a spinoff, him spinning the trident and her spinning the lasso.
Oh, yeah. I could see them getting competitive like that.
That's a pretty good kick, full extension. So they have some functional action sequences here, but none of them rose to the level of like the trench or rose to the level of like in Veld or whatever, when she kind of goes through and busts down the wood and busts out the window. Like, I never had anything that to me hit me as good as a couple of those moments in the first movie from a kind of a Wonder Woman powerful action kind of standpoint.
Do you think it's because a lot of these are not only just small, but they're intimate? Like this sequence within the White House, there's very few people, it's closed off, there's no one really witnessing it except for the people involved in it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a right. And there's not as many of the supporting characters that can react to it and stuff like we had with the trench and No Man's Land. You know, you can kind of see her team that's like, wow, like she pulls them out and inspires them forward. And sometimes it's the reaction that makes something seem more potent or more powerful, not just the action itself per se.
Yeah, I guess this Cheetah Wonder Woman fight is more personal. You know, there's a person-to-person contact versus what it means for other people. Although they are fighting other people within this location.
If I think of it again through the 80s kind of framework, it gives me, like, it makes me a little bit more forgiving of some of the action stuff. Again, if I'm like, okay, if they were going for 80s, then in some ways that might work better that way, thinking of it as 80s action rather than modern action.
I have to remember, this is a very significant thing that they are fighting. They're having this fight in the White House. Yeah. This is a place which would have had Secret Servicemen busting in there. There could have been armed military people who showed up. They are fighting in a very... There could have been a school tour group in here, for all we know.
Right.
This is a very significant place that they are destroying. So I have to think about how it's not just like a personal fight between Diana and Barbara. This is a American history that they're fighting in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've tilted paintings and.
So there's a nice little bit of the personal connection coming back between Diana and Barbara, and having some dialogue between them. Not just the fight. And now with Diana being kind of weakened, it actually makes this a more...
Evens it out.
Even fight, or even Barbara having the advantage a little bit. In terms of the action, though, I was saying the action, you know, to me was not quite to the level of the first movie, but I do think Kristen Wiig did fine with what she had to do in these action stuff, which was surprising. Like, I hadn't thought of her as an action-oriented kind of performer.
I think as long as you... If you really sell the performance of it when the camera's on you, I think I'm willing to buy the stunt performer, you know?
Yeah, of course.
She's not the one being like thrown through things, but she has to sell the emotion of it.
Right, exactly. The parts that she performs within this, I thought she did fine for her part of it. There's Wonder Woman on the ground again.
Wonder Woman on the floor may not be the last that we see of this. It's very disappointing for me to see. And I know that the part of the story is that she's reeling from the wish that she made that she's now having to deal with the consequences of. But
yeah,
I don't know. I just, that's a very defeated Wonder Woman.
Yeah. I'm not going to ever really come around to thinking that it's a good way to position her in like the key moments of it. I mean, maybe you could kind of have her down here, but then not at the end. But if I was trying to think about like, why did they think it was a good idea? You know, with the young Diana at the beginning, when she needs to learn her lesson, like Antiope does throw her down and kind of stands over her. And it sort of puts her in this position of, you kind of need to be taken down to learn your lesson or to sort of see things differently. And so maybe they took that a little too far of like, we're going to put her down on the ground again and then again.
I think that's a really generous read. And I think that's one that I think is pretty fair and very thoughtful. Because I think she does have to learn this lesson. I think of all three of these main characters who are affected by this, I think Diana really takes it in and has to deal with it more than any of them.
The later part though, at the end, which I know you've commented on before when you've reviewed this movie, you know, back in 2021, I think, I still think there's a way they could have improved it or handled it differently at the end, but it's just like, why in the world did they even think to put her on the ground? Maybe that's what they were thinking of was sometimes you have to be knocked down and that's where you're receptive to learning a lesson or something like that.
Yeah, but I guess I can get that, but I think, towards the end of the film, if we're having Diana or Wonder Woman learn how to fly, you know, have her rise above it, you know.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm still not going to be a fan of it, especially the later one that's coming up towards the end. But I'm trying to think, like, what the heck were they thinking?
Yeah, and I think your point here at the end of that White House sequence, I think is actually very fitting. She has been defeated. The villains came in and whooped her butt, and she's now going to make a really difficult decision. So I think that one is actually really appropriate for the story at the time.
Yeah. I think even the later one, we can maybe see it when we get there, but even the later one, maybe she starts on the ground, but then she could have gotten up but instead she just stays on the ground, and it's a visual medium. And so like, that's the visual you leave it with. Is just her crumpled on the ground and So
I guess we'll see if we view it any differently on this time around.
Yeah. So, okay, that's a little police brutality there. To me, this also just kind of my honest reaction to it. To me, this was just a little bit of over the top of like, okay, we get it. Things are going hectic. Things are going chaotic. But it's just like they're just strewing like every single extra and every single set decoration and everything is like, oh, it's chaotic. Everything's going to heck. It's like, okay, we get it. I don't know. To me, it seemed a little bit over the
military is on the streets. Yeah.
But like it's not just World War III. It's like every single person in every single situation is like just crazy and hectic and out of control and blah blah. Like it was to me, it just seemed like, wow, you took an idea and you just way overdid it.
I did like the there's a thing behind Steve Trevor that says God is something and it's covered up. I did like the street preacher who was talking about sin and your greed. I sort of see that as like a meta narrative that someone is talking directly towards them.
Yeah. To what everybody's kind of like, what has led to this is everybody's collective greed of having their wish and wanting it just fulfilled. And
even specifically for Diana's, she was greedy. She wanted Steve Trevor back from the dead.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, who can blame her, but still it's selfish.
So this is, that this is requiring Gal Gadot to do some acting with some emotion. And I feel like she brought it. I feel like she pulled this off.
Yeah, I think she sells it.
And it's good. I'm glad that she pulled it off. Cause if not, the whole movie kind of would not work.
This movie.
Yeah. This movie has to be sold the emotion right here. But I think she did it. You know, she's not going to win an Academy Award, but I think she did what was needed for this part.
Well, and she's selling the emotional beat that Diana is dealing with right now, because she's having to say goodbye to him again.
Yep.
But I guess for me as a viewer, I'm just so, I was so frustrated with her for making this decision that I kind of like didn't care at the end of it. I was like, good, finally, you made a good decision.
But, took you long enough, yeah.
But it, but in terms of the character having to walk away from him.
Yep, like I actually pull away.
I feel that.
Right. She has to pull away from a kiss of her true love, but has to realize, like, can't take the shortcut. You can't have the easy way. And they were saying it's very hard for anybody to renounce their wish, you know, so she was able to do it. So that's her strength, right? She had the strength to renounce the wish.
Yeah. The running is a little goofy, that visual of the running.
It's so hard.
It's a little goofy, but I guess if you had the ability to super speed, you'd look a little goofy.
And I also feel like it did have a little bit of the Linda Carter
sense
to it as well. So again, if it's like Patty Jenkins, like a huge fan of Linda Carter, it's like, yep, that's what Wonder Woman looks like. But before the run, I think she did a pretty good job.
Oh, yeah. And I think it leads into a really nice effect sequence.
Mm-hmm. So she's not only getting some of her kind of core strength back, but now she's going to actually add some new abilities inspired by Steve, which is kind of nice that it comes on after he has left.
Yeah.
It's sort of something that she can take up as part of his spirit.
The experience with him was not for nothing. She learned something from it and was able to take that aspect of him with her.
Mm-hmm. And again, like we were talking before about like which version of the characters individuals might prefer or something. So like for me, I don't need Wonder Woman to be a flying character, but I'm not opposed to it either. So it's like, okay, if this creative team, they wanted to sort of add that on, then I'm like, okay. Like I said, it's common in the second movie that a little bit more powers are added. They did connect it with the Steve, you know, personal connection. So it's meaningful in that way. So it's like, I probably wouldn't have had a fly in Wonder Woman in my choice, but it doesn't mean I need to impose that on everybody else's creative vision for it.
Well, and I like that it's visually different than Superman, the way.
Her mechanics of flying is her own. Yeah.
And it's a little more like with the Helen Slater Supergirl movie, they showed her flying as more of a like a super ballet sort of thing. So I think it has a little more femininity to it in the way she flies. And it's also a way to give her this big release. You know, she's done this big dramatic thing where she had to renounce her wish and say goodbye to Steve. And here she's able to take out that emotion in this new power that she has and release all of that while she's in the air. So I think it accomplishes multiple things at once.
Right. The answer is always more. Yep. So that was kind of, you know, the reputation the 80s had was the extravagance and the accumulation and things.
Life is good, but it could be better. It can be better.
He's looking pretty rough now.
He is. Oh.
So it's funny. We can tell that he's looking terrible, but he's thinking I'm getting closer and closer to invincible. Like he's thinking that he's getting stronger and stronger. It's like, dude, you're losing it.
He's lying to himself.
So this is another little pivot for Barbara. Instead of being like Diana, she's going to be the alpha.
So I think this wish, I think that was the wish that I had a problem with because I don't remember them touching or her touching Max to make that wish to be able
to
make Max Predator.
So I couldn't quite see below the frame, but it did seem like they were sitting on opposite sides of the plane, so it would be a little bit too far. Although he was kind of talking about, even though she already made a wish, he was kind of saying there's still a way to make another one. So maybe it was like they were just planning what they were going to do, and then maybe they did it off screen.
I guess so. I'm like, you did so well with setting up your rule and sticking with it, but except for this one big one at the end, you didn't show it.
Yeah, and she did actually say the wish phrasing, so it did seem like she needed to be touching him in some way.
Yeah. So now Maxwell Lord has assumed the highest position in the land. He's he has gotten to the point where he's making an announcement as if he is the president of the United States.
Yeah, using that global network. Love the old TVs. They do have some big projectors there. Yeah, so this is kind of appealing to the selfishness that everybody kind of has, you know, saying like, yes, follow those selfish instincts, appealing to everybody's kind of worst nature, really.
And I guess everybody would have different levels of what they would wish for if they could wish for anything. And they could be, they could be positive in nature, or they could be like selfish, like I want to be famous, I want to be rich, or they could say, I want to, you know, have something good happen to one of my loved ones, or I could wish somebody to drop dead.
Mm-hmm.
It is bringing out the worst in everybody, like you said.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, hey, a little selfishness isn't bad, right? It's like, oh, it's not one of the positive human traits, the selfishness, I don't think.
And if everyone was selfish at the same time.
Yeah.
all around the world, if everyone acted on that selfish, greedy instinct, the world would be a mess. If we didn't think about other people, if we only thought about ourselves, that could be a bleak world.
All right. So she's going for the Asteria armor. Like, I feel like I might have missed it, but I feel like what would have been a nice thing is when they were telling the story of Asteria, if there was something that was about selflessness or something like that.
Oh, yeah,
she was always giving and that she didn't seek anything for herself or whatever. I feel like that would have connected in with the theme more as, like, the counterpoint to it. But instead, it's like, well, Asteria seems like she has a pretty sweet set of armor. Like, it seems like she's got kind of the best, you know, kicks and wings and stuff. Didn't seem like she was too frugal in that regard, but.
Because I guess the opposite of greed would be selflessness or altruism, something like that. So
like generosity and selflessness, I think. Yeah.
Right. I think the only one here, I kind of like the idea of the son being the embodiment of the opposite of what his dad has.
Yeah. To me, the son is actually the better counterpoint than Asteria is. Yeah.
Because he's the one wanting the best for his dad. He sees his dad out of control and making the wrong decisions, and he just wants his dad to be okay.
Yeah, we don't need all the riches and all the oil and all that stuff. All right, so yeah, so I don't know. So I've watched this. I think this is my third or fourth time watching it. I think this is supposed to be this really impactful moment, and for me, I'm just like, okay, she's got the armor on now. Like, it didn't hit me in the gut punch like the movies that I really love do, you know?
Yeah, I think it's more for Wonder Woman fans who love the comics and are like, oh man, she has that Golden Eagle armor. I think it's one of those things. And I think you can only make that work if you have a flying Wonder Woman, because she's got wings. So she has to be able to fly. So I think you have to establish that before you put her in this armor.
Oh, that's interesting. They might have said like the flying and this kind of armor kind of go together. And you need to have them both in the same story kind of to make it make sense.
Yeah, and I guess the idea of her wearing this is she's still maybe regaining some of her strength, maybe? You know, what's the point of her putting this on? Is it to connect back to Asteria and how good she was? Or is it just because she needs to fight a really powerful foe?
Yeah. To me, it's one of those things where it's like, on paper, you set it up at the beginning, you had a reminder of it in the middle, and then you brought it in here at the end. And I'm like, okay, you check the boxes, but at least for me, it just doesn't hit me in the powerful impact kind of way that I would want. But the cheetah part does. We've been watching Barbara's transformation and getting to this point. I thought that arc worked pretty well.
Yeah, and even in the, because we were sort of trying to track her clothing, and I think it was sort of building to the cheetah look. Mm-hmm. So I think that really went all the way through.
Yep, her hair definitely, this is the end point of where her hair was headed. And then, they had the allusions to the cheetah cat print kind of thing.
Yeah, and the fur and all that kind of stuff.
But then for me, again, like, nothing really wrong with this fight scene, but it's still, I was realizing I'm getting closer and closer to the end, and none of the action scenes have, you know, impressed me as much as the first movie or like the Zack Snyder movies or, you know, her action in BVS and that kind of thing.
I'll tell you what it is for me is that, and I think this goes back to Patty Jenkins's view on Wonder Woman as this, you know, peaceful love character, which is great. That's great. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. if you need somebody to battle a foe, she needs to have some aggression in her to be able to attack. Right mm-hmm. now, she's just, it's all defense.
Yeah.
You know, she's cowering with the wings. She's trying to protect herself. She's not going mm-hmm. on the offense with a lot of stuff. And I think that's what I would want to see out of Wonder Woman, is her to really go after it.
Mm-hmm. She hears, she said, nothing good comes from lies. So that goes back to the truth. The truth is, you know, to pursue.
And kind of the lie we tell ourselves through the wish, you know, like if I had this thing, it would be better. But that could be, you know, you lying to yourself.
Right. And yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. It is kind of a self-delusion to think these wishes will make everything better or make me happy or something.
Yeah.
This is a kind of creative use of the lasso to kind of give this flying combat sort of look.
And I think having this in a darker environment, like at night, it helps the lasso to stand out, the electricity mm-hmm. to stand out. And it also thankfully hides Cheetah a little bit. So some of the makeup for Kristen Wiig is not as noticeable. So it sort of hides that a little bit. So I think the use of it at night, I think is a good choice.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's very reasonable to do that. Things can go wrong with CGI cat or, you know, versions of people can go badly.
The night setting is very forgiving.
Yeah. That was kind of nice that I actually just noticed that's kind of a cat move in the water. Like the cat does not seem to enjoy the water.
Oh, yeah. No, cats hate water. They're not big fans, but.
Nope, she's not going to do it. Most people can't. I think that's nice. We're like, so in terms of the characterization of Wonder Woman, I think it's good that she is trying to get through to Barbara, trying to reason with her. That kind of fits the character a lot in, you know, in versions in the comics and stuff.
So is electrocuting someone better than using a sword on them? Is that... what's the justification for that? I guess maybe she's just shocking her. Maybe she's not killing her. She's just trying to debilitate her in some way.
She's still... And it, you know, electrocution leaves their body intact, whereas a sword often might decapitate, you know, right. or cut off limbs of the person, which seems more violent, I guess.
I also have somewhat of an issue of the fact that if you just renounce your wish, it's over and it's fine. Everything's great. Like all you have to do is, it's an easy, you talk about
there's a pretty simple out if you're willing to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. That kind of goes against the theme that I think they've set up so well is that, you know, you cheat to take the shortcut. Well, I think the shortcut is renouncing your wish.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right. There's a shortcut out of it. The shortcut out of it is renounce it. And there we go. Yeah, that's true. I think there is some of this. The thematic stuff doesn't all hold together as well as I hope on some of this stuff.
For me, I would want it to be more of an active, like I'm rectifying this through my action kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I do notice, too, I'm here with Rebecca from Supergirl Radio, and now we have a public address that's happening through the camera that's going out to the world, which is kind of a trope on Supergirl series.
Oh, yes. No, it's Supergirl's thing to be able to give a hope message through the camera.
Are all the cameras on me? Is everybody watching? Okay, here we go.
I have a secret identity I need to keep, but I'm going to be on TV. But yeah, so Wonder Woman takes a play out of Supergirl's playbook where she's giving a message. She's going to give a message of hope over the airwaves, which is very passive. It's a very passive thing. And I didn't even like it when Supergirl did it.
I think I'd be okay with like one of them or something, but then once Supergirl seemed to get to the third or fourth time doing it, it's
yeah, it became a real trope on the Supergirl TV series, which is why I kind of rolled my eyes when I saw it happen in this movie. It's like, oh my gosh, I hope
yeah. But also, like, what's happening here? So is Diana getting defeated by wind? Like, is the wind just swirling around so much that she?
So this wind, I think, is connected. So when they initially made their wishes, there was just a little bit of breeze that would happen when.
Right. Yeah.
So I guess this is all of the wishes all at once happening, and it's creating this huge tornado.
Okay, so it is like possibly billions of gusts of winds that are all accumulating.
It could be like this crazy powerful thing, but still, Wonder Woman should, I think, be able to withstand that. She's very powerful.
Yes, and also, hasn't Wonder Woman just realized how to like float with the wind and respond to it in
right? She way. Should like, be it's flying like, around this whole thing.
Yeah, I would think a normally powered Diana should be able to handle it, and then also literally a Diana who you just showed us has been able to navigate the wind very artfully. It's like, oh wait, but now the wind is putting her on her back. But okay, here we go. Okay, truth, sure. A little bit.
So she's in this defeated on the floor, back up against the wall stance.
Mm-hmm.
Again. This is not her moment of defeat. She should be I thought she should be standing up. But I think, Sam, we need to talk about the music that's in the scene.
Yeah, so it sounds a little familiar.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts about them using The Beautiful Lie here?
So I remember they tempted in, like Hans Zimmer, I think, used it as a temp track to just sort of see how it plays. And then Patty Jenkins and him talked about it or something. They're like, they really liked how it worked or something. So they kept it in is, I think, what I heard. So first of all, I agree with you. If she's down at first because this is the like Antiope put her down and now she's learning the lesson from Antiope of, okay, truth is what's important, no shortcuts. I do think she should rise up as she's making that point and learning lessons. So even if she started down, I think she needs to have stood up by this point and needs to be coming forward in a more like proactive, powerful way.
And defeating the wind, you know, as people announce their wishes, it should be lessening.
And she's kind of moving through it. Yeah. So, all right. That kind of wraps up that part we've been talking about. But in terms of the music, so Beautiful Lie. So Bruce was lying to himself at the point when this music was first introduced. Like he was lying to himself that he will find fulfillment in his mission as Batman and that will somehow, you know, it's not going to bring your parents back. You're not going to find happiness with that. You're so isolated, you know. So I can see how Batman or Bruce Wayne was also deluding himself and was almost looking for an easy way out rather than realizing, no, you actually need to open yourself up to connections and you need to, you know, come out of the darkness. So I can kind of see that connection there. But the fact that it's being played when Wonder Woman is turning the corner is a little bit weird. Because to me, this music is actually when Bruce is still in the lie. It's not the music of Bruce. Right. It's not Bruce's theme of him coming out of the lie. It's the music of him actually deluding himself in the lie.
Yeah.
So I can see how it connects to this movie, but I don't see how it connects to this moment, like right here.
Yeah. If you were just going based on like the word lie and she's talking about the truth and all that kind of stuff, I can see maybe, but you're right. That music in BVS plays at the very beginning when Bruce is going through the trauma of his parents' death and falling down into the cave with the bats.
Yeah, and it's the what falls is fallen. Like it is the music of the descent of his own self-delusion and tunnel vision and stuff. It's not the music of him coming out of it, you know.
It should have played maybe when she made her wish.
Yeah.
That would
or at her low point that she had earlier. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, so maybe somebody else is seeing a way of spinning it the other way, but that's my first reaction of it, what I think of with that song, like with that music. So I can see a connection. And I love the song. Like I love that.
Oh,
I love that melody.
Fantastic. Yeah.
It's beautiful, but, I'm not sure if I'm totally sold on. I also though might be biased because I agree with you that I don't think this is how Wonder Woman should have ended her movie. Like the, you know, climax of the movie. I don't think that's her position that she should have been in. So that also might make me biased against the music to think that it wasn't working quite right.
Well, it's also not Wonder Woman's theme. It's Batman's theme. And so just on a pure like motif level, that's it doesn't go there. I think it's nice to be able to connect these movies in the same universe, but I think maybe they could have taken Wonder Woman's theme and done a variation of that.
Yeah, a totally different setting of the theme or something with a different mood to it. Yeah.
Maybe have Wonder Woman's theme played by piano, you know, something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like
a
slow piano. You could have done that.
Right. There was probably a lot of really good nuance in the exact words that she was saying, but I wasn't tracking all the words. And to me, it's you show, don't tell, right? So it doesn't just matter what she's saying. It also matters like what visual posture you've put her in.
Yeah.
At the end. For me, though, this what I did react to well was him having this realization of like, oh, crap, my son is what I should have actually been focusing on, not accumulating all of this power and all this money and stuff.
So I wonder if the Dreamstone did take over, and when this power was letting up, more of Maxwell Lord was starting.
His humanity is back. And when his humanity is back, it's like, oh no, I actually am calling out for myself.
Yeah. I like that emotional center of it. I just don't think you can. I think the fact that you can just renounce your wish and everything is fine, and you face no consequences to it.
Right. And even like, so it's nice that Diana is like redeeming him.
Yeah.
That's a credit to Diana. But it is a little bit awkward that she's like, go save your son. You know, like you just totally wrecked the whole world.
You wrecked the whole world, literally.
But just go for it. Be with your son. Yeah.
I also think it's a disservice to the reality of what we go through. You can't just screw something up and then just say, oh, my bad.
Undo,
and then it's fine. Like we live in a real world where if you screw something up, if you hurt someone, if you make a bad choice, you're gonna have to own up to it and try to rectify it and do something to make it better. And I know this is not the real world. This is a movie based on comic books, but I just feel like that real aspect of it, that could have been really impactful if he had to face the consequences to what he did.
Right. Well, it's like you said before, if the point of the movie is there are no shortcuts, this is what we're seeing right here is pretty much a shortcut to putting everything back together.
I mean, one of the extra people, the no-name people, was like, I wish you were dead or whatever. And like, he almost killed a lady, you know, stuff like that, where I'm sure people died because of those wishes. And to just say, I renounce my wish and it's all fine. I mean, that's
disappointing. And the military guys, like, they're all disappearing, like all these bombs or, you know, explosions or whatever, like they're all disappearing. It's like, oh, that's a nice little undo, you know, like a little.
Oh yeah. Control shortcut to that out of there.
Yeah. But yeah. But then for me, if I sort of put all that aside and I just look at this here, I thought the kid did a really good job throughout this movie, just in terms of the kid acting. And for here, Pedro Pascal back together with him.
I think
if I overlook a lot of stuff and just go right into this moment, and like, that's kind of cool that they give the villain this little humanity touch. But
yeah, and I guess you're giving a little bit of a message of, you know, it's not what you want. It's what do you have that you can focus on that can make you happy and that can be fulfilling to you, instead of focusing on things you don't have that you want. Maybe what you really need. Maybe it's not about what you want, but it's what you need and what you already have that you should be focusing on. So I think there's a positive message in that.
Yeah. And for him here, what he's doing now is he's actually being honest with his kid. He's saying like, I've been lying. I'm not a great guy. I've made these mistakes. And before, he was trying to basically pull one over on his kid, like, you know, trying to make my kid think that I'm successful and all this stuff. So they're not just reuniting, and there's not just the humanity coming back, but there's also he's turning towards truth and he's kind of learning the lesson. But I do hope after this scene cuts, he faces some sort of consequence.
Yeah, when I first saw this, I was like, oh, that's a sweet scene. Where's the guy with the handcuffs who was going to arrest him?
That should be my
reaction to that. Yeah. He should immediately be arrested after this.
Yeah, but it'd be like, that's nice. That's good. Also, you're under arrest. In this way.
You can have future conversations through a jail cell or something. Yeah. He just got away with it scot-free. And I guess you could justify it. Like, how could they sentence him if nothing actually happened?
Mm-hmm. I am on this rewatch. I am realizing though that I really like Pedro Pascal in like Act One, a little bit in Act Two, but I didn't love the performance all the way through into the Act Three. I'm fine with this ending that he had, but I didn't love what they. Maybe it was the writing of the character. I didn't love it all the way through, but I did really like his Act One, how they set him up and how they got it going.
He does give it his all, though. I will.
Yeah, I think as an actor, I think he. Yeah, he went all in it, and you could see his franticness kind of taking over.
And this non-Steve Trevor guy is wearing his scarf.
Yeah. So a nice little callback to the snow in the first Wonder Woman film. It's magical.
It is. Snow is magical. That is correct. Diana is no longer in white of any kind. She's got kind of a Wonder Woman blue on.
Yep, she's a little bit more open to this kind of thing instead of just brushing everybody off all the time.
She's wearing a scarf as well.
Oh, yeah.
But I guess it's cold, so.
Yeah. So it was 4th of July. The fireworks were 4th of July fireworks, right?
Right.
Or was it, yeah.
No, it was 4th of July, yeah.
So, okay. So we're several months later now here.
That's Gal Gadot's real husband, and I think her daughter on that merry-go-round.
Oh, cool. I didn't realize that.
I think that's right.
Would make sense.
One of my biggest like gripes with this movie when I reviewed it for Supergirl Radio was the dialogue said so many things so much, and it really annoyed me. I was like, can you be a little more descriptive? Like, tell me what that means.
Yeah. But, and once you notice it, then all of a sudden it starts to expand out a lot.
They said it quite a bit. But I guess I like the ending there where she's looking at all of the people there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You could, or I could read it as like she's seeing people who maybe they have some bad things that happened in their lives. Maybe they made some bad choices, but they're all out there still living their lives and interacting with the world.
Yeah. And that the pleasantness of that sort of scene is a lot, you know, it contrasts with the chaoticness, like all the franticness that I was talking about before. Like, so it does have that visual contrast of like, look how pleasant this is and how happy and everything's going nicely.
Yeah, it's not World War III in Washington, D.C. It's people out enjoying the holidays and the snow and being around each other and spending a happy time together. So I think that I guess that's where we're supposed to leave with Diana, is that she's learned that maybe, you know, no matter what happens in life, you know, life can still be beautiful, even if Steve is gone, even if she doesn't have what she wants. Maybe she can still enjoy the life that she has. I don't know.
The credits here are even done in 80s style.
Yeah, I like that aesthetically.
Yeah. And I know it's like an oversimplification to talk about the decades, but, you know, 80s was known as the extravagant decades of greed is good and all that stuff. And so, you know, this is, I think, trying to basically be a rebuke to that. This is a nice little touch. I know this meant a lot to Linda Carter and Patty Jenkins.
Yeah, and when her back is to us, I assumed it was Gal Gadot at first.
Yeah, you figure it's Diane here, and it's nope.
And she's got the scarf on as well.
Yep, and she goes by the actual name Mysteria.
I think it's a nice Easter egg
and,
you know, post-credit sequence, but I do kind of wish it played more into the actual story of things.
Oh, there we go. Special appearance. Yeah, I feel like, you know, big Wonder Woman fans are going to just love it and kind of connects it together. And, you know, turning out that this is the last Wonder Woman film in this universe, it's kind of nice that they did bring that home, make that connection, you know.
Yeah, I'm glad they gave her that opportunity and worked her into it, because like with Superman, with Henry Cavill, you know, Christopher Reeve's not around, so you couldn't do something like that with him. So
right. I'm glad they had that. And Linda Carter has always been so positive and like so supportive of all of it. So it's kind of fitting that they tie her in.
Yeah. So, and I love this music at the end, during the credit sequence. It's the, I think it's the music that they played during the, like the, Themyscira Olympic thing.
The opening competition. Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah.
I don't know what that track is called. I feel like I should know that because I do have the soundtrack, but I think it's that same music, which is very good.
Cool. Well, what's your overall thoughts to close? Like for me, it's still on the lower end of my DCEU kind of, you know, rankings, but that's because I like the vast majority of the DCEU films, even the ones that are kind of divisive. I tend to like a lot of them. This one, you know, we tried our best to stay on the positive side of things and there's some enjoyableness to it, but like it just never to me rises to that level of like something that I love or that I really appreciate in like deeper ways.
I think there are some good threads that we tried to pick up on the idea of the no shortcuts all and how that impacted those characters. But I think we did find that as we discussed it and analyzed it, that it did fall short there at the end because everyone around the world took a shortcut. So I think the writing, if I was going to say where this movie really faltered, I think the writing is what failed it. I think the direction was pretty good. The effects are pretty good. The acting is pretty good. The music is pretty good, even though I would prefer a little more 80s touch to it. And I think some of those character beats, I could see where there were good ideas there. But I think for me, the writing really failed it because it didn't really connect those dots in a big way where Diana actually learned a lesson. At the beginning of the film, it talks about learning a lesson, and I don't think she did. So I think if you really dig into it, there are problems with it. But if for, you know, a movie, if you're just like lazy on an afternoon and you just want to pop something on, I guess it's an enjoyable watch. But there are some things I can't get over in terms of the writing.
Yeah, I did. You know, I picked up on a little bit more of the parallels to the first movie. So I was like, okay, it's, you know, Patty Jenkins is putting some of her mark on both of them. And I could see how it's a sequel that connects to the first one. I don't think it lives up to the quality and the coherence of the first one. And I think a lot of people really do not appreciate, or they don't buy into the 80s style to the action itself. It's like, they're like, okay, I know it's 80s. I know they're setting that as the context. But the fact that Patty Jenkins and the stunt team and stuff decided to even do some 80s style action and gags even and that stuff, I think a lot of people were like, nope, doesn't work for me and stuff. And I'm sort of like, I could be fine with that 80s style to it. But I agree with you. It's some of the writing of it. It doesn't all quite tie together. Some of it falls a little flat. Even with like going to Egypt, it's like, okay, you go to Egypt, but then you pretty much just do a road vehicle like scene. Like you had Egypt around you, but you pretty much just did trucks, you know, jockeying for position on the road and then flipping a truck. Like they didn't embed the action into Egypt in like,
it could have been lassoing around a pyramid or something.
It just ended up being a street scene. Once you actually got to the action. So like there's some of those things like that where it's like, okay, you were close, but you didn't quite bring it all together, bring it all home, you know?
Yeah, I think I'm sad for Patty Jenkins that she doesn't get to like finish with a little stronger movie. I don't think Wonder Woman 1984 is as bad as people claim that it is. Mm-hmm. I think it is bad in a lot of ways, but I don't think it deserves the vitriol it gets. I think there are worse injuries in the DCEU than this, but I think there are some really positive things about it. I just wish they had made the storytelling a little more consistent and actually had a consequence to the end. Just because I think it sends a bad message where it's like, oh, you could destroy the world and it would be fine if you just say my bad.
Yeah.
So I think it isn't as bad as people say, but I think there are a lot of problems with it.
Yeah, and we could watch it again looking for the negative, and I think we would find even a lot more than we got on this pass. But Anyway, we've got it there. I do appreciate just going through it with you, and it was fun talking through it. So thanks for coming and doing this.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to be back talking with you about these movies, because I know we both share a love for this universe, and it's always really fun for me to talk about it with somebody who actually cares about storytelling and filmmaking and takes those things seriously. So I really appreciate you letting me do it with you.
Yeah, and also just appreciate seeing all your good content with Supergirl Radio and on YouTube. You have good stuff coming out, so appreciate your insights on all of it as well. So,
yeah, if anybody wants to check us out on Supergirl Radio. I also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/duckmilkprod, trying to do some more Snyder content, some Rebel Moon stuff, and more film analysis. I like to talk about films and film reviews and how to review things. What we did tonight, I think, was, or what we did for this episode was actually a really good practice in how to not bring your feelings into it, but actually analyzing it for what it actually is, looking at the merit of something. So, so I'm trying to practice that.
Right. And you can have feelings and kind of acknowledge them, but then they shouldn't take over everything. They shouldn't, you know, completely determine how you view the creative work.
And I think you're very good at that. So I appreciate that you practice that and exercise that.
Yeah. And if people are interested in critiquing the critiques or reviewing the reviewers, Rebecca's one of the best ones at that. So, all right.
Well, I try to learn from bad mistakes, from bad wishes that other reviewers put out there. I try to learn from those.
Yeah. Well, all right. It's great talking to you. And we'll have to do this again for another movie sometime.
I'd be all up for it.